Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Yeah, Friday comes early. It's 6 o'clock in the morning here, and people are wondering, well, why do we do Friday so early? Well, it's just because of the reporters and the arrangements, and, you know, why do we start Thursday at 10 o'clock? Because that's the way it works best. So we're flexible here and can do that. Derek Park, our fabulous financial guru, is here with us a bit early because he's off to the Blue Angels. We'll talk about that too for a minute, but let's get started with our financial report. Money. What is it? How does it work? How do you get it to work for you? So many choices. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, commodities, and then there are the markets. Oil, gold, manufacturing, trade, energy, even government. To make sense of all the places your money can go, Derek Park of Edward Jones Financial Advisors joins us Fridays at this time to make sense of the markets and your money. Well, not always at this time. This is kind of a special week, but kind of early for you there, dude. How you doing?
It is very early for me, but, you know, the Blue Angels are a yearly staple with me and my group of friends. So if you don't get down here early, man, you don't get down here.
Oh, no, it makes perfect sense to me. I used to watch them myself. In fact, when I was a tour guide in San Francisco, we routinely would come back late from one of our tours. I used to drive these motorized cable cars, and we would go to a place called Fort Point, which if you look it up, it's at the base of the Golden Gate Bridge. And it's a three-level old fort from the 1800s. It used to guard the entrance to San Francisco and Golden Gate Harbor. It was called the Golden Gate before the Golden Gate Bridge. Oh, yeah, it was great. So we just sit there. We watched the 747 fly, you know, almost between the towers. We've seen, you know, F-22s go straight up. And the nice thing about San Francisco Bay for an air show is air show center is Alcatraz. So all the surrounding communities, Sausalito, Berkeley, Oakland, everybody sees the show. And the boats line up, you know, all throughout the bay. And it's an event. And you want to see the Blue Angels someplace, go to San Francisco Columbus Day weekend. So as much as San Francisco is totally falling apart, that particular weekend is spectacular. So I understand.
All right,
Blue Angels
man.
For years. Yeah.
Yeah,
so anyway,
that sounds cool, man.
Yeah.
Well, back then, hell, they were probably in, like, different aircraft, weren't they, or were they still in F-18s then?
No, they're F-18s. They, I never saw the A-4s in. Well, they probably did have the A-4s. Yeah, they did have the A-4s, the Skyhawks in San Francisco. I was there 30 years, so I got there in '84.
That's about the timeline I was thinking. So I was like, yeah, they had to be A-4s.
Yeah, then they got the F-18s. People still, though, you got to cover your ears when they go overhead. Okay, those afterburners are like 120 decibels. Don't lose your hearing, folks.
Oh, sure.
But it was always. Now here's what they used to do. They used to fly between the buildings in San Francisco, and then of course Feinstein and the leftists. You know, they wanted to shut down the whole show. And of course, San Franciscans. See, San Francisco is a military town like this town. You know, people don't realize that the Pensacola, you know, and San Francisco had the Missouri for a while. San Francisco is where World War II was staged from. It wasn't Los Angeles or San Diego. It was San Francisco. You know, Hamilton Field, this is like 8,000-foot runway there. The B-17s going to the Pacific, and the B-24s used to fly out under the bridge. They fly under the Golden Gate Bridge, which was built in 1936, right? And so these guys would fly under the bridge, you know, on their way to war. And then, of course, the next stop was, Hawaii, Hickam Field. And then they go from there to the Pacific. And so there's a lot of military history in San Francisco, and there used to be a lot of bases. We had a submarine base. We had Treasure Island had a base. The Navy used to have the Orions, the subchasers down at Moffett Field. Blue Angels performed there. You know, so it's a huge, it's like seven military bases. I think most of them have gone now in the purge, the Obama purge of the military. But it used to be a very big military, always is a loyal military, heavily veteran city until, of course, you know, the crazies took over. And that's where it is now.
Well, they still got Presidio still there, San Diego still there, still in the area. You know what I mean? So still plenty there.
Well, the Presidio is non-military now. Presidio civilian. The last time it was military.
There's still military people there.
Well, I'm sure there are. Yeah, but they used to have the Army Hospital. There was a fabulous Army Hospital. I forgot what it was, but it was one of the best in the country. I forgot who it was named for, but anyway, yeah. But I remember when it was still military, I don't know if you ever heard of, we're having fun this morning, this is great, the 50th anniversary of the Golden Gate Bridge. Did you ever hear about that?
The what now?
The 50th anniversary of the Golden Gate Bridge, where they totally screwed up.
No.
This is back when I forgot who the name of there's an amazing rock and roll, Bill Graham. Bill Graham was the rock and roll promoter, and he was associated with the 50th anniversary production. And he said, "You people are nuts. I'm leaving," because they wanted to do a 3-hour walk across. And of course, Bill Graham knew that, you know, once people start walking, they're going to get packed. So what happened was, the bridge almost collapsed, and I know because I was in the center of it when all this happened. And so we all got up early. We walked across the Golden Gate Bridge, and then, of course, we start walking back. But what we didn't know, what happened was the officials screwed up. They were supposed to cut off the amount of people walking through, and they didn't. So you've got people walking onto the bridge all the time that those of us who are on the other side, plus the other side people in Marin County walking back. Well, we all met in the middle. We blocked. That bridge almost collapsed.
Was it like a weight issue?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you figure, you know, one person per square foot, okay,
yeah.
that's 100 and, what, 50 pounds average per square foot on that bridge. It's much more than the trucks and cars, much more.
Oh, sure.
There are pictures in Newsweek of the bridge sinking in the middle, and I know because I heard it clanking. We were all looking out the side going, okay, if it goes, where do we go? And we were figuring where we were going to jump and hope for – no, I'm serious. We were planning this. one guy beside me got so upset he had a heart attack. He collapsed right there.
Oh,
so I grabbed the next biggest guy my size, and we forced our way through the crowd, which fortunately they made room when there was no room. We carried this guy off, put him in an ambulance, and off he went. And that's how I got off the bridge. Yeah, it's a great story. But it came so close. It was like 150 times its maximum weight capacity. It was you know, all bridges are overbuilt. At least this one was. It was built, you know, but the engineers were like, oh, my God. Because you can see pictures of it sinking in the middle.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I'll look him up and post him sometime. Anyway, back to more modern times. Speaking of sinking, of collapsing bridges of finance and everything else, what the hell's going on with our country, if I may sum up?
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely economic trying times. I try to remain positive. There's always a silver lining in the bad things that are going on. I would say we're terrible at predicting things. You know what I mean? I think the government's terrible at that. Analysts are terrible at that. You know what I mean? What that basically goes to say is that the markets are very hard to pin down. What we do know is if you stay invested long enough, you will end up with an average return, right? So that's why we do what we do. You know, so obviously the economic times we're in right now, we still got Russia weighing heavily on us. We definitely still have inflation weighing heavily on us. You know, the Fed, obviously behind the curve, is aggressively raising rates in an attempt to get people to stop spending money, kind of slow down the economy on purpose, without going into a recession. And, as the news is starting to grab hold of, I think they failed in that endeavor. recession is starting to look more and more inevitable if we already aren't in a recession right now. You know, we've met the criteria already for half of it. All it takes is for us to just kind of sign off on the other half, and we can officially say we're in recession.
But don't we have 2 quarters? Don't we have 2 quarters now of
negative growth? We've already had 1 quarter of negative GDP, right? So
the last quarter beginning. Okay.
We haven't yet. Unofficial report is it was negative. It was negative GDP. Next to the ball. As soon as the official report comes out, another report today that's very important is the unemployment report. Obviously, with layoffs and corporate slowdowns, unemployment should start to spike, and that's going to also meet the criteria for a recession. So, you know, we're definitely growing towards that number.
Well, they want it, you know, unemployment means the economy is slowing down, which they want to end the recession, but it also means unemployment is going up. So it's a mixed bag. They want it, but they don't want it.
Right.
Huh.
Right. You know, so, well, what I would say is it either needs to go ahead and get over with or, kind of quit toying with it. Does that make sense?
Well, there's a more direct expression, which ends with, or get off the pot, you know, so I'll leave it at
right,
that.
Right, right, yeah. I mean, exactly. I mean, that's really what
they're not doing. Well, they're lying.
Yeah.
The White House is, you know, for them to stand up their bald face and say, this is the greatest economy ever. We're so much better than Trump's economy. I mean, it's laughable. It's not even plausible. I don't even know if they believe it. I mean, they're either stupid or just lying through their teeth. I think they're lying. I think they know it's not true. I think they think we'll accept it, but we don't. And since all the reporters
to kind of soften the blow to people. But, you know, I mean, the bottom line is you know, I mean, we're here. We have to deal with it. You know, the silver lining in all this is if they go ahead and say, hey, we're in recession, understand we're already halfway through it. You know, so the recovery should begin, right? Once the recovery begins, you know, we should start to see better performance.
Well, I got a question. First of all, are you in a place where you have the regular report, or are you on the road somewhere, or what's going on?
I have the regular report in front of me.
Okay, good.
I am on the road, but I have it in front of me.
Okay, we'll get to that in a second. But what I was thinking of is that given this, you know, insurrection's preponderance for not understanding the economy, trying to sabotage it, going through this mythical solar wind, you know, energy situation, even if a normal recovery would take place by doing nothing, because that's what happens in an economy, it goes in cycles, these folks are going to screw up the recovery too. That's my belief, because they screwed it up getting us into the recession and having massive inflation, and the fact that their energy is based on a warped ideology that doesn't work. I don't see any reason to think that they would do anything less than completely screw up the recovery now that they've completely screwed up the economy. I don't think they can do a recovery. Like I said, the best thing would be to do nothing, but they're not going to do nothing.
Obviously you have to understand some of these things operate independent of what they're doing. I mean, do they have to deal with the taxes that they've put forth? Yeah. Do they have to deal with you know, limitations that are put forth? Yeah. The only real limitations are going to go to the energy industry. Everybody else is you know, free to operate freely except the cost of doing business. And, you know, obviously if transportation costs are high, then, you know, that's going to get pushed right down to the consumer. So, while inflation is potentially not here to stay, which, mm-hmm. I mean, it shouldn't be. I mean, if you take Jimmy Carter days, it was like a 4-year cycle. We're already 2 years into this cycle, right? So we got another 2 years before it kind of topples back down. But inflation, even though it topples back down, is going to set some type of new high, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
That new high is really what everybody's going to have to deal with. You know, so is that going to be an average of 5 to 10% higher than it was before? Who knows when it finally settles? You know, but when it does settle, obviously, this is where we move forward, and, you know, that sets the new pricing on everything else. You know, and here comes the problem with, you know, drastically raising the minimum wage. You know, I mean, I agree. We're definitely behind the power curve on that. You know, but when you just slam it from, you know, 10 to 15, you know, great. I mean, everybody's happy to hear that, but guess where that money's going to go? It's going to go right back to the consumer. So, you know, while the fact that you're paid more, you're going to be paying more for things. So it kind of washes itself out immediately. You know, so, you know, everybody thinks minimum wage is supposed to support you. That's not the way it's supposed to work.
No,
you know what I mean?
No.
It's called minimum wage for a reason. It's entry level positions. You know what I mean? Like you're supposed to kind of move forward with it. Now, I mean, if you want minimum wage to pay your way, work two jobs, you know what I mean? Like then, you know, I mean, you can kind of fill in the blank. I mean, there's people that do that. I mean, they just live at that level and they're comfortable. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I don't.
People have it backwards. You don't, you know, set the income is not set to your lifestyle. You set your lifestyle and your capabilities to the income that's available. So everybody's doing this backwards. Mm-hmm. They're looking at it backwards. I got Pianca in the line. I want to get to the report. I just want to tell you something real briefly. I wrote a article, which I should drag up again for you, where I created this new thing called the Total Revenue Index. If you only measure somebody, and we've talked about this before, if you only measure what they're getting by minimum wage, people that are generally on minimum wage who are independent, who aren't, you know, living in mommy's basement, they have other things too. They have Section 8 housing. They have WIC, food stamps. They have other cash benefits. They have multiple, you know, child support, $3,000 a year tax credits. They have all kinds of stuff. So if you want to measure how much people are actually making, you've got to take into account every source of income, including, you know, our government taxpayer paid for benefits. And you'll find that in Hawaii, it actually, I remember I did this study, Cato did this, I think I wrote this maybe somewhere around five, six, 7 years ago. They were making between, I think it was around $60, $70 an hour. If you break it down into an actual hourly wage with all the welfare that Hawaii offers. Mississippi was the worst. Mm-hmm. They're only making about $25, $30 an hour. So,
yeah,
so
well,
you know, you've got to take the.
I mean, I live there, so I can tell you.
Yeah. Now, the cost of living is lower in Mississippi than Hawaii, but that doesn't account for it. But the problem is that people, you know, you think of the minimum wage as an isolated case, and it's simply not, because people who are getting minimum wage, who are independent, are eligible for a lot of other stuff. And so you've got to take into account the total revenue index. And what you find is that most of the people on minimum wage and plus welfare are making far more than people who have above minimum wage jobs, who are simply doing what they're supposed to do, which is work for a living, as opposed to living off the rest of us.
Right, right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's get to the report. We'll get to Pianki. We've got 15 minutes. Shirley Watchell, and she has Tess Salve, another woman gun competitor coming in. So, and you can say hi. You guys never get a chance to talk, so feel free.
Gotcha.
So what's going on? And you can say page two. Say page two on your report so we know you don't have to, like, skip through it and make it awkward. To Paul Harvey. Page two.
I got to flip the page.
Well, let us know
today,
what you're doing.
Okay.
It's kind of funny. Just bring it, put it right into the report.
I got you.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, good morning, everybody. This is Derek Park with Edward Jones, bringing you the daily financial market report. Stocks were higher today as they took to extend recent gains. Growth-style stocks again outperformed, a sign that underlying market trends could be moving to support more growth-style stocks in near term. Oil futures for August have fallen recently, pointing to an average cost of a gallon of gas between $4 and $4.25, down significantly from $5 plus seen at the pump. Oil closed around $103 a barrel. U.S. Treasuries continue to trade in range-bound fashion, near 3% today, while the year yield curve continues to warn of recession. Jobless claims ticked higher as planned layoffs, especially in the tech sector, take shape. Notably, Bitcoin, which has seen as many as a gauge of investor willingness to take risk, seems to have bottomed and is moving higher, which is a point to a bottoming in investor sentiment as markets look past to a potential recession in near term. U.S. equities closed higher today with the Dow Jones up 346 points or 1.12% to 31,384. NASDAQ closed up 259 points or 2.28% to 11,621. And the S&P 500 closed up 57 points or 1.49% to 39,02. In the bond market, 10-year Treasury yields trading at 3.01%, higher by 0.09. Page two.
See how fun this is? Just incorporate what I did. Yeah.
In the commodity markets, the price of crude oil was up $4.14 or 4.4% to $102.67, and the spot price of gold was up $3 or 0.17 to $17.39.50. This is Derek Park of Ever Jones, member SIPC. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
Real short second page. That's all right. Let's get Pianki's question, then I want to talk oil and why the price seems to be dropping at the pump, which I find fascinating. So, Pianki, your line's live. You're on with Derek Park a little early. We got a special edition, so he can go watch the Blue Angels. Morning, Pianki.
Edward Jones. You know, in St. Louis, they have the Edward Jones Dome, which used to be the TWA Dome, which I was a major steel erector on that dome back in 1995.
There you go, man. Well, you can't be an affiliate on that dome.
You need a dome, Eric.
No, you got a $30 trillion, probably more than that, debt. And this is just, you raise minimum wage. Inflation is still going up. You do away with major industries that's been around for a long, long time that pays billions to consumers, families, pensioners, and so on. This is a path down a treacherous way that has no ending.
Yeah, I would say that it's going to be rough, but a little thing of note is inflation is great for the government. So you know, you got to keep in mind 4 years of the government stacking cash like there's no tomorrow. Obviously the debt is significantly compounded with Jimmy Carter, but the deficit actually went down when inflation happened back in the 80s. So I don't know that that's going to happen now. I'm sure if it does, the current administration would do cartwheels and it would be on headlines reeling for days on end, because that would be the only significant accomplishment that happened, I guess, that they could tout. But, there is a little bit of silver lining in it, so I wouldn't look at it necessarily as a bad thing.
Oh, I
but
would.
You know, Derek, given
Go ahead.
Given the nation's revenue, which is what, about 3.5, maybe $4 trillion, the 4.5. Total revenue that they do. 4.5?
Yeah.
So how much of that can you pay toward a national debt and also the interest on the debt, where is it really making any gain whatsoever? How many years out are we talking about? 50, 60, 70 years?
I don't know the answer to that, man. I mean, I'd have to do some research. You know, I mean, I understand where you're going with it, but, you know, I mean, it's you know, the debt's going to keep rising if the government doesn't find a better way to spend the money. I mean, or spend less money, excuse me. You know, so where we're at right now, unfortunately, is where we're at until somebody makes some changes. I mean, we can lobby, we can pick people, but it's nothing's going to change if nothing ever changes.
Well, we've got a potential cure. It's just a question of whether folks, you know, pick up on it. In fact, I love the Wall Street investment writers. I don't know if you know anybody that can do this, but we have a bill, constitutional amendment, to take away the power of Congress to borrow money. That would stop the national debt from increasing. That would cause, as we've talked about before, the automatic payment of the debt through the bonds. That would lower the national, that would lower the debt interest, the interest on the national debt. That would lower inflation. You know, that would, because without borrowing, you really don't have inflation. That would end the printing of money, because the reason they print money is to cover the borrowing. You know, so the only things that this would do, and people say, well, it's pie in the sky, that's a dream. No, it's very real. It's a very real thing that we may be faced with considering the alternative. They may not want the alternative as we head for economic suicide. So there is a way around this. But I don't know if you know any writers on Wall Street, Derek, or you know anybody that does. But now is the time to start talking about, you know, a constitutional amendment to end borrowing.
I mean, I agree with it, but I don't, I'm not connected like that. It's like, I'm about as local as it gets, man.
Yeah.
You know, you know, definitely, I mean, I appreciate it, but it just would be something that I wouldn't even know what to do with or even how to get people involved.
When we get Trump on the show, I'll ask him, and that's how we're getting it going.
That's right.
I just pulled up an article, Governments Love Inflation, and They Won't Do Anything to Stop It. This is Mises Wire. This is the Mises Institute from 10-19-2021. Yeah, I'm not going to read the article now, but it's out there. But there are reasons, and I've forgotten why it is, but governments do love inflation. And so that is a problem.
What's more tax? I mean, you have to understand. Yeah. I mean, if everybody's paying more, that's more tax revenue. You know, so, I mean, the tax revenue.
Is that because the prices are up?
That's right.
The prices are up?
Yeah. So,
okay. So more sales tax.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So more sales tax on higher price of goods. So you have to imagine, I mean, the government right now is making 30 to 40% more than they normally were. You know, I mean, so if they're making more, you know, I mean, you know, you got this $3 trillion budget that was signed. You know, and I mean, everybody signed it. I mean, the Republicans fought it because there wasn't a lot of infrastructure in the bill. There was a lot of social system support and a lot of things that weren't going to help the American people.
Mm-hmm.
There was less infrastructure, more other products. So, you know, I mean, obviously they printed all the money to cover all this, and then obviously handing out free money too long for COVID. You know, I mean, obviously inflation was bound to happen. You
but they
know,
don't
so
care though, because they make money off it. So they make money off the printing.
Right.
They get power by printing money, so they can give it away. The printing of money creates inflation, which gets them more tax dollars. There's no downside for government to doing this. This is why they do it. People don't realize that this is all by design. You know, if you really want to stop inflation, you give back you put the money that there's. You cancel all future spending from those $1 trillion bills. You stop printing the money. You cut future. go ahead, Derek. What's that?
No, the Fed was mysteriously behind the power curve on raising rates. You know, it's like,
That's by design too. So this could be well entrenched in the economy. But here's the problem with the Fed. The Fed, when things are going right, used to have 3% inflation as their goal. Well, they should have all been fired for that. You don't take away 3% of America's money as a goal. That's irrational.
Right.
It should be 3% deflation a year. Our currency should be increasing 3% a year. Our prices should be dropping 3% a year. The wealth of the country should be increasing, not decreasing. We should have fewer dollars in circulation, making them more valuable. You know, what would happen to the investment accounts of everybody if the dollar increased 3% per year? What kind of purchasing power? Oh, you'd have the same amount of dollars, but probably. What kind of purchasing power would that be as the price of everything drops? Everybody says, well, you can't have deflation. Of course you can have deflation.
Golly, the value of everybody else's currency would be worthless.
Well, no, but then, and I thought about that too.
Then we
but if the American economy, but if the American economy is so strong because we have deflation that our money is worth so much, we're just going to trade with each other. We don't need all these other people.
You know, another thing, too, that people don't consider, what you call Social Security, Medicare Part A, B, and D, federal debt held by the public, plus federal employee and veterans benefit, that totals out to $170 trillion, $370 billion. Plus,
wow.
Well, that includes debt, too. $170 trillion. There's no way in all universe that that's going to ever come to a zero. It can't. It's just the math.
No.
The numbers don't work out.
They also raised, they raised Social Security to kind of keep up with inflation. So people with Social Security got the biggest raise that they've got in like 25 years. But they also raised Medicare. So Medicare, your Medicare used to be, I think it was $148.50, if I'm not mistaken. They bumped that up to $170.50. While they gave everybody extra money, they took more away from Medicare, you know. So, it's any time the government's going to give something to you, they're going to find a way to take it back. You know, I mean, all these people that want these debt forgiveness programs and all this other stuff, that sounds well and good, but somebody's got to pay the piper. And when they do that, you know, I mean, obviously you're going to cause more problems somewhere else.
There's
more tax to cover it.
You know, Derek, no one considers the fact that the debt forgiveness of college loans is unconstitutional given equal protection in the 14th Amendment. Because if you're doing that, you have to debt forgive all the people that went to vocational and trade schools. You have to debt forgive every small business loan. You have to debt forgive anybody who got any kind of investment or loan, you know, government-wise. Otherwise, you violated equal protection. You can't give money back to rich middle-class college students. You can't do it.
They've actually done it already with the colleges that went under. There was two colleges that were mentioned, like ITT Tech. Do you remember that?
Oh, I remember them. I remember their ads.
Yeah,
they never stopped.
ITT Tech, and there's two other ones. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but you could easily look it up.
We get the idea.
Those colleges that went under, for a program, they're actually covered by some type of insurance. All their loans are going to be forgiven, which I necessarily agree with because their certificates and all their stuff now is invalid. You know what I mean? So
that's different. It's not so much forgiven.
It is.
It's not the people who made the loans that didn't pay them back, that the loans are now worthless because the college, you know, the degree is worthless. I understand that. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
And I remember the story with the B. It was something institute. Anyway, Shirley's on the line too. Shirley, if you want to jump into this, you'll get a chance to talk to our financial guru, Derek, very often. So feel free to leap into our conversation. I'll let you know when Tess gets here too.
Yeah, not at 6 o'clock in the morning, you don't.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we're never going to see him again, so this is your only chance, Shirley, unless you call back in later some Friday. Good morning.
Not much of a morning guy.
Yeah. Well, I guess Shirley's still having her coffee too. Let me.
I was here. I was just waiting for. I'm just waiting for time to chime in there.
No. You got to just leap right in. You got be brave, be bold, be loud. That's how you get in. All right. Well, let me ask a question then, real quick, because I know Derek has like 2 minutes left. Oil.
Yes.
It seems to me fascinating. I read an article, I sent it to you, on the oil futures and the fact that our prices, it was $4.54 something a gallon 2 weeks ago, and last night I paid $4.17 a gallon. In this economy with the starvation of energy by the Brandon insurrection, how can that be that the price dropped, 35-40 cents a gallon in 2 weeks?
So the price of oil has gone down. Did you see the article? You tagged me on Facebook. So did you see the article I tagged you back with?
I don't think so. I don't know. I must have missed it.
Yeah.
Please enlighten me.
You tagged me with an article that basically said, hey, why is oil going down? It's because commodity traders are anticipating a severe recession, you know, and it was like, it was a doomsday article, you know, and I'm just kind of like, okay.
This is why I like to, you know, post articles, and if something I've posted is wrong, just tell me. I mean, I don't care. I want to know.
I don't think it was entirely wrong. I think it was written a little harsh, you know. So is it true that commodity traders are attempting to short oil. Yes, they are. That is happening.
What does that mean?
You know, they're basically predicting that the price of oil is going to fall. Okay. So what they're doing is they're putting futures against it, saying, hey, the price is going to fall. That's called shorting, right? If it doesn't fall, then they get what's called a margin call and they get slapped in the face. You know what I mean? But commodity traders are right. They're attempting to say, okay, going into a recession, which if we go into a recession, you know, people tend to bottle up. So they're predicting based off statistics that that's going to happen. Well, let me give you some other statistics, right? Out of the 13 recessions that we've had over the past 90 years, seven of them, the market has ended in green numbers, right? That's if they've happened inter-year, the market has ended up in green numbers, okay? That includes oil out of the seven. So only five of them have ended up very bad, right, if that makes sense, okay? Out of those, one was only one that lasted more than a year, okay? And that one, if you're not including the Great Depression, you know, you're talking about 2008 and 2009. So there's only one that fits outside of the norm. So by saying severe, they're predicting that the worst of the worst is going to happen when nobody knows, you know. So you're talking about commodity traders. The article that I tagged you with was one written by Goldman Sachs that says, hey, while this is going on, it's a little bit overblown. And they gave you numbers behind it. They basically said, okay, here's a number of contracts that are out there, and here's the percentages, you know. And they were basically saying, hey, it's only like 5% of contracts, which is a low number. I mean, if you start seeing 10% contracts over overall shares, then yeah, that's probably a high number. That's going to draw concern. So basically, they were just saying, hey, don't let people fool you into saying, hey, the worst of the worst is coming. Now, I mean, granted, look, I mean, you're an economist, you understand this, right? So we could already.
Well, I asked for other people too. Yeah.
Right, but you know, we could already be in recession. I say could because I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that you know, typical recession cycles are 13 months, right? Typical, you know, that's literally about 8 or 9 of the recessions that we've had. You know, so we're already 7 months into it. So what do we got? Another 5-6 months, and then boom, we're kind of done.
What do you call a recession? Now, I know it's 3 quarters. When the first quarter come around, it looks. What is that? How do you describe that?
Well, we've already had 1 quarter of negative GDP, Piyaki, so that's already met half the criteria. All the criteria is to define a recession is 2 consecutive quarters of negative GDP. Now, typically, there's other things that come with that when you're in recession. That's like bottomed out oil, high unemployment. There's other things, but those are not requirements, right? Those are things that are additions to what's going on. You know, so in employment, we're going to have an unemployment report today. So when that comes out, if unemployment's on the rise, we're kind of now meeting more of those criteria. Does that make sense?
Got 10.9 million unemployed, according to this information.
Yeah. I'm going to jump in here for a second because we've got our other guests. We've got Tess Salb on the line. We've got Shirley Watchell. But I just want to give them the opportunity, if Derek, if you have a couple more minutes. Tess, we do things here. All our reports overlap. So if you have a financial question before we start talking guns, now's the time to ask because I only have one more question. I don't know how much time Derek has, but we've got the hour. So we've got a little bit of chance to do that. Tess, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
I know you've only been on for like a minute. Do you have any financial questions real quick? Or do you want to maybe try another time?
No.
Okay.
Well, that's fine.
I do this to people all the time. Don't worry about it.
I'm on the marketing side of things. I don't really do finance.
Okay. Well, that's fine. Well, let me ask you one last question, Derek, and that is on demand. Because I've heard the two things I've heard were that the oil futures, that they're predicting, you know, the dire consequences. So they're actually now they buy lower, right? So if oil is $100 a barrel, so and they get a 6 month contract, that they'll say they might bet it's like $80 a barrel in advance, assuming that it's going to go lower or something. How does shorting work, just real quickly? And then we'll get to other folks.
Yeah, so shorting works because let's just assume it's $100 a barrel, right? Shorting basically says. We think it's going to be $80 a barrel in 2 months. I'm just making up a timeline, right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, with that timeline, they'll say, okay, who wants to buy oil at $80 a barrel, right? And somebody will be like, okay, well, I'm willing to pay that price. And what they're saying is, okay, we're going to borrow the shares from you at $80, right? Because they're $100 now, and you're going to I'm going to gamble that they're going to get there, and you're going to buy this contract, right? And they pay money for this contract, and that's called the spread, right? They pay for the spread, that $20 spread. If it happens, they get paid based on that spread, right? If it doesn't happen, if it goes the other direction, that's called a margin call. Then they have to say, okay, it went to $105 a barrel. Well, now the spread is short $5. You got to fill in that gap. Does that make sense?
Yep.
And you got 2 months for that to happen. If that doesn't happen in 2 months, then the contract expires and you have to write a new contract.
That's what we call commodity brokers gamblers. Well, last question.
Well, they do this with any stock, Greg. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is. They do it with anything. You know, I mean, so Tesla, I just tell you a funny story. Elon Musk had short shorts, right? He made silk short shorts because there was literally so many short positions against Tesla. He made a joke about it. Go Google that. That's real.
Oh, I believe
those shorts. I think he sold like 500,000 pair of those shorts for like $100 a piece or something like that. It was ridiculous. Right. Pretty serious business.
You know,
man, but,
I'm
walking out. I gotta get, man.
No, that's fine. That's okay. Yeah. I'll ask you about
be careful, Derek. Have a nice weekend.
Okay. All right, you guys.
You know, on your question, Greg, what shorts is a stock? That is, if you sell on the put side, you sell the stock for $100. Now, in the regulation says that when you open a position, you got to do just the opposite to close it. So if you buy, you got to close it with a sell. If you sell, you got to close it with a buy. So if
I know it's a weird world.
It drops down to 80. You buy it back for $80, and you get to keep the 20 difference.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. I want to talk about more detail because commodities is like gambling. And I actually passed the Series 7 test. I was a stockbroker for a day. Hold, what's that? Real quick.
You know what would be a good show? You read the Federalist paper, the Anti-Federalist paper. You should take this U.S. debt clock and go over each one of these categories and explain to the listeners and let them know just how dire things really are.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's get Shirley and Tess on it, and then stick around, Fiaki. This is going to be a wild show today.
When one is faced with a crisis, you find your true character. How you react to such an emergency can determine the rest of your life. Two paths present themselves for you to choose. One leads to tragedy. The other leads to becoming a new person. Shirley Wattrall, a survivor of a dangerously abusive relationship, is that new person. She's the author of Heels to Holster. She is a firearms instructor, motivational speaker, women's empowerment advocate, and a reporter for Action Radio. So now, here is the DC Project, Women and Guns, with Shirley Wattrall.
And special guest, Tess Saad. See you both, a round of applause. Tess, how do you pronounce your name before I totally screw it up? Saab.
Saab.
Go ahead. All right.
Saab.
Okay. Where's that from?
Now we got that. We got that out of the way.
Let's get the awkward stuff out of the way first. Where's that? I'm just curious where that's from. I have not heard this name before.
It's German.
Okay. Well, it's got to be short for something else. There's got to be more to it. It's like my name, last name Pengos is short for like Pengalopoulos or something like that. So in ancient Greek, whatever. Yeah. Anyway, enough of that stuff. Shirley.
Yeah.
Welcome. Your guest. Feel free.
Yeah.
I can sit back and listen.
Good.
Yeah.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Today we have Tess. Hi, Tess. We have Tess on the line. And Tess is one of the very amazing ladies I've met since I've been in the firearms community, but I didn't know how amazing she was until she sent her bio over. So I'm going to touch base on what she's done in her short life, because she's pretty young, and we'll discuss it more as we go along. But at the age of 12, we kind of talked about this last Friday, she competed in modern pentathlon. And last week, kind of tested Greg to see if he knew what that meant. And do you remember?
I remember it well because I know what it is. I didn't know what it was for the gun competition, but I know pentathlon is one of the two big Olympic events. The other is decathlon. Pentathlon is 5 events, and decathlon is 10 events. And it includes running, pole vaulting, high jumping, discus throwing, javelin, and whatever the other events are. But for the gun stuff, it's completely different. So I will let you tell that story. You and Tess can tell me the pentathlon of shooting.
Right. So with that, and I'll let Tess describe that a little more in detail because I'm excited to hear that as well. But that included running, swimming, shooting, fencing, and horseback riding. Also, at the age of 15, she competed in the U.S. Olympic Festival. She was on the U.S. National Pistol Team for 12 years. She competed in five World Cups representing the University of Notre Dame in the NRA Intercollegiate National Pistol Championship.
And how old are you? How old is this person? How much have you crammed into your life here?
This was decades ago.
Oh, decades ago. Oh, okay. She modestly says, no, this is my previous life. Now I'm mature.
It's kind of how it feels.
Oh, but there's more. There's more.
Oh, please tell. We got the hour. Do relate.
Yeah, she qualified for the 2000 U.S. Olympic trials. She's competed in three-gun USPSA, tactical games, which I really wanted to get her to describe that as well.
Yeah.
She competed in the 2005 Ironman USA. She founded and ran one of the largest CrossFit endurance teams in Northern Virginia. And she's director of marketing and communications for Hi-Vis Shooting Systems. Now, is that not the most amazing bio you've ever heard?
Let's give her another round of applause.
Much. Yeah.
I'm impressed. Shirley, you don't mess around with your guests. I mean, you bring us the best people. This is amazing. I've got a ton of questions. Let me just ask one before we get – oh, sorry, go ahead. Who was that?
Okay.
Was that Tess? Or was that Shirley?
That was me. Go ahead.
Okay, live radio. Isn't this fun? I want to ask about Olympic shooting. I'm curious how that has changed. Because it looks like you got a bunch of different events. I imagine those are fairly recent. Olympics is about the only sports I actually do watch. And so that'd be my first question, and I want Shirley to definitely ask a lot more. But you're involved now. Are you on the Olympic team? Have Olympic sports changed for shooting? Used to be what shotgun and biathlon was about it that I remember. What's going on with that?
Actually, they've had rifle, pistol, shotgun. Biathlon is a winter sport. So while it is one of the shooting sports, it's not. They're underneath their own governing body. So they're underneath U.S. Biathlon. So they don't. I trained with them a little bit, but only during the summer months when they were in Colorado Springs, because that's where they would do their off season, but that was our competitive season.
Okay.
So the USA Shooting is the governing body for the Olympic program, and underneath that they have rifle, pistol, and shotgun sports. So over the years, I mean, shooting is one of the original sports of the Olympics since the inception of the gun, essentially. And it took the place of things like rock throwing and things of the Greco-Roman games with the invention of the firearm. So over time, it has changed. It's changed a lot since I was doing it. The last time I was in the program, I think, was 2012. And then it's a great program, but it takes a lot of time and a lot of work. So it's kind of hard to have a full-time job, and there are people who do it for sure, but it's definitely it's a lifestyle because you live and breathe the Olympic team because everything is a qualifier one into the other. But a little tidbit of information that they had a men's free pistol, and that was one of the only original Olympic sports that up until, I think, 2012 or maybe a little bit later, it had not changed from how it originally started, from the course of fire to the target to everything, but that now has also changed. So since I've left the program, they have added team events. They've changed the courses of fire just a little bit, but I will admit that since I'm not in the program and since I've been dabbling in other sports, that I can't speak directly to the rules that have changed and things, but it's still around. And it's actually fascinating because they're always trying to hit the smallest targets, or for shotgun, the fastest targets. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's interesting in this world where they're trying to get rid of guns everywhere that, you know, the Olympics still have firearms events, which I think is wonderful. Shirley, I'm sorry. I get curious.
Do you see that much media coverage of it? I mean, I watch the Olympics. I don't know where you find the competitions like that so you can view them. So, yeah, that's pretty interesting. I didn't know they had all that in the Olympics because I'm like, oh, where do you see that?
Yes, unfortunately, the last Olympics we had, there seemed to be a lot more coverage of it, specifically the shotgun sports, which the United States excels at. But you are right. In the United States, we don't see a lot of coverage, but you can go to some of the European countries and shooting over there, at least Olympic-style shooting, or I think they call it gallery shooting, is much more popular. It's kind of like tennis or something like that. So, it's country dependent. And then there are other countries, Greg, like you were saying, that they don't have firearms at all. They don't allow it. They don't have teams that can qualify. And that's actually a very controversial thing. A lot of people don't know that for the Olympics, every time that an Olympics is held, there are specific sports that are voted on as to whether or not the host country will have those. And I think for the next Olympics, they voted something out, and don't quote me on this, but you can look it up. They did vote something out like powerlifting, boxing, and something else. And I don't know if it was because the country didn't want to have the venues built, or I'm not quite sure, but shooting is one of those that actually comes up for a vote quite a lot because, you know, they don't want to host, well, one, firearms laws. It's very difficult to get guns in and out of some countries, which is why some of the shooting has actually changed from the higher calibers or down to 22 down to air gun, which is exactly what happened in modern pentathlon. And modern pentathlon now, because they compete in so many countries, does laser shooting. They don't even shoot real firearms. That's one of the
Wimps.
Sports. When I started modern pentathlon when I was 12 years old, we shot 22s.
Right.
When I competed in the Olympic Festival 3 years later, we went to air guns. So we were shooting 0.177 caliber. And now they've gone to laser shooting. But if you don't know the story of modern pentathlon, it kind of what they're doing right now makes a little more sense. But it is the sport that was devised from a modern day soldier, essentially modern day, meaning after the break in the Olympics. And they were the five sports that a soldier had to be competent in, at a time of war. And the story goes that, a soldier is asked to deliver a letter from point A to point B. And in the course, he starts out on horseback, gets into a gunfight, runs out of ammo, his horse gets killed, he has to sword fight his way, swim a river, and run to his destination. So those are the five sports that a modern-day soldier had to be competent in. And so they created an Olympic sport about it because the Olympics were very much about testing soldiers and military and athletes. You know, those were the athletes back in the day. Because it was survival, everybody was a soldier, right? That's kind of how it started. And actually, a fun tidbit of information, George Patton was one of the most favorite modern pentathletes ever.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So
as the sport, you know, as they compete in the sport with the Olympics now, it's all individual events because they have to back when I was doing it, you would go to the shooting venue, and because it was air gun, we could shoot in like a cafeteria or coliseum, and then you could fence in the same location. But then you have to move everybody to the pool, and then you have to move everybody to the equestrian center, where we would ride and run. But now what they do, they have actually combined, and I just learned this the last Olympics watching it on TV, they have combined the run and the shoot into a laser shooting event. So it is kind of a biathlon of sorts, but they do it at the equestrian center. And I think they did this for one of a few reasons of it's very difficult to get tickets to modern pentathlon because people lose interest from venue to venue, or if traffic or something can hold you up and you can miss an event. So they're starting to combine them to increase the spectator participation. But then the
they just need a
mile
long course. You need like a mile long field with a pool, with a water, with a lake dug out. You know, a horse
right?
ride. You know, you just need to put all these things in one you know mile long strip and have a drone
right.
following you guys.
Exactly.
This is easy. I can fix
exactly.
this.
Exactly.
So that's
kind of
what.
Surely.
Go ahead.
No, that's kind of what I pictured it would be. That you know, when like in Three Gun, you have different stages. And I thought, how in the heck do they do all five of these in like one huge stage? But from what you're telling me, they'll do the swimming part, and then maybe time it, and then they'll do another section, and then add all the scores together or something like that.
Well, that's the way
they do.
Traditional decathlon, pentathlon, right? Because you'll have the pole vaulting, the high jump. You don't do them all in a string. They separate them, and they just combine your scores. I remember when Bruce Jenner
right,
was Bruce. I mean, I remember watching it. That's how they did it.
Right.
we get political,
sure.
I just sneak it in. Don't worry about me.
Under track and field, I'm not quite sure how that stuff goes, but for modern pentathlon, your unlimited events are your swimming and your running. So those are the ones that you want to be really good at. Otherwise, you can shoot a perfect score, you can only beat everybody in fencing, and you can only ride a perfect ride.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of that's how the scoring system worked. But combining the run and the shoot, what they're doing now is they'll run – I think it's like a 400-meter lap, and then they shoot, or maybe it's 800 meters, and then they shoot so many shots, and then they run so far and shoot so many shots. And I'm not really as up at this. Like I said, since I've been so removed from the Olympic program for so long, I'm a spectator now. I get my information from either my friends or
you're old.
The news. Exactly. I'm retired.
What are you, like 23?
So,
I'm just teasing you.
So, Tess, how and why did you get involved in the pentathlon competition? What motivated you?
So I was absolutely in love with horseback riding. And at for some reason, when I was, I think, 5 or 6 years old, I grew up in a small town, ironically, since you guys were talking about oil, in an oil town in eastern New Mexico, West Texas. And not much to do there, but my mom owned a dance studio. And my dad was he was a teacher, and then he also was went back to school to get his PhD in psychology when I was in second grade. He already had a master's in chemistry and biology and all kinds of stuff, but he was continuing his education. And I at some point in time announced that I wanted to go to the Olympics in horseback riding. So being from a small town, my parents were like, okay. Sure, you know, not thinking anything
not?
Of it.
Yeah.
And,
wow.
Right,
yeah.
Because that's people from
that's
like,
nice,
Tess.
Okay, what else do you
want
to do tomorrow? See what your mind goes to then. Okay, fine.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know how this goes.
Well,
yep.
Ironically, my dad got stationed in San Antonio, Texas. And so he found a place for me to horseback ride when I was 12 years old in San Antonio when we would come to visit. And it happened to be the Olympic Training Center for equestrian.
Wow.
And they also
had
modern pentathlon. Exactly.
Yeah.
So they kind of got word of me. Colonel Russell, who was the owner, saw me ride one time, and you know, he kind of heard my goals and stuff, and he told my parents. He said, "Well, she's, you know, she's really good as a rider, but she's 12 years old. Most equestrians are like in their 30s, so she has time." So he said, "Why don't you let me introduce you to my son, Johnny Russell Jr., who is in charge of the Junior Modern Pentathlon program." And that may be a better fit for her when she comes out here, because it'll be, you know, she can still ride, but she can do all of these other things. So I went to a Christmas camp, did a couple things. We did a fencing day. We swam a little, which I have a swimming background because of my dad. He also had one. But I'd never done it competitively. I loved the water. We ran, we ride, we rode, and then we shot BB guns, air guns. And so I was like, okay, you know, that was cool. Didn't think anything of it. So we came back in for Easter, and I was at the tack shop getting my favorite place to shop.
Of course.
And we ran into some of the girls who were there, and they were like, oh, are you here for the competition? And I was like, oh, what competition? And they said, well, there's a modern pentathlon comp. I don't know why. To this day, I was like, sure, I'll do it. I had never shot a gun in my life. I had never swam 200 meters. I'd never fenced anybody. I'd never run a mile and a half, but I did it all because I could ride a horse at the end. And so we signed up for this competition. My parents were like, oh, okay, I guess we're doing this. So we went out that night and got myself some running shoes and some running shorts and some goggles and, you know, the basics, I guess, that I needed. Showed up at Fort Sam Houston that next day, and first time to ever see a gun in my life. I shot it in competition, and that was whenever we shot 22s. Needless to say,
I didn't do very well. But that's just amazing that you just jumped in there and just said, yeah, I'm going to do this, just so you can basically ride the horse. But
I love horseback riding so much that I would do anything to get on a horse.
So just out of curiosity, Tess, if an Air Force recruiter said, by the way, we have a spot in F-16s open up, would you like to try it? Would you have done that too? I mean, I'm just curious.
Probably. Oh,
yeah,
to try it? Absolutely, sure.
Yeah, had a feeling.
I'm kind of a yes person.
Well, see, but that's the difference. Okay, now this is really critical. You know, if we actually, you know, get serious for a second, to being open to life's opportunities. So many people, their first reaction is no. And you'll always regret what you didn't do. You know, and there's very few things I've said no to, but the ones I have is like, oh, gee, you know, why did I do that? Because there's only so many times in your life when you can do certain things. And so this is absolutely critical, the fact that, you know, that you were open to these possibilities. But there's other folks, which is kind of interesting. Like, I wanted to fly jet fighters from the time I was, I think, 4. You know, I first saw the Blue Angels, like, whoa, I want to do that. You know, and I happened to wear glasses at 19, so I couldn't do it, okay? You know, and I'm still waiting for my Blue Angels ride, and here I am, 60, you know, something.
Fingers crossed.
Well, I'm going. I just a question of when. I keep, as Action Radio gets bigger, they'll say, Greg, we want you to ride the Blue Angels and say nice things about us. I'm like, yeah, you bet, you know, but I want to go upside down in supersonic. Okay, that's the deal. And so, but being open to these things is incredible. But a lot, like I said, there's two ways to do this, I think. There are those that dream about their whole life and try, and some do and some don't. It just depends. But and another time, it's just like, you know, well, that sounds interesting. Let me give it a shot. And it's just, if you're open to the possibilities, you never know. Like we're open to possibilities here for all kinds of stuff. And I have the most amazing reporters, you know, just because I said, yeah, come on, try it. Let's give it a shot. Let's see what you can do. Shirley is brilliant, by the way. Shirley is absolutely, you know, one of the best parts of our week. And just because, and I don't think Shirley ever thought of being a radio broadcast person, but she's taken to it like, you know, as well as anybody ever has that I've seen here on the show. And so she was open to it. And away we go. So there's a compliment, Shirley.
Thank you for that. And no, I had never planned on doing anything on radio or any other stuff that I've already accomplished.
She's great at it.
So it's good, you know. But I don't think I have that personality where I'd say, just because I want to go horseback riding, I'm going to just jump in there and do all this other stuff and never shot a gun, never did any fencing. I don't think I've got that much determination or competitive edge. But I think that is just truly awesome that you did that. At that young age, too, I guess at that age, maybe it was kind of fearless. I don't know.
You know, I'm not quite sure. But I mean, you're right. You know, saying yes is a big thing. Saying yes to opportunities, kind of understanding, and being able to be completely vulnerable. You know, because I'm not quite sure I hit a lot of targets. My parents still tease me to this day because everybody, the coaches were from foreign countries, you know, so most of the coaches were from Poland that I worked with. And so with their accents, they would go out there.
Why Poland?
Just because they had a huge modern pentathlon program. Modern pentathlon is huge overseas. It used to be huge. And so there's a couple reasons why they came over here, but the coach I actually ended up with was out of New Mexico Military Institute. And so he was from Poland, and so he had a couple of other friends. But they were the medal winners. You know, the U.S. only had a couple of really good pentathletes who were medal winners, and so they would bring over a bunch of competitors or coaches from foreign countries, and a lot of the Olympic programs are still like that. They want to hire the best for the team. So I trained with people from Germany, Italy, France, Russia, Poland, the Czech Republic, all over the place. I can't tell you. It was great as a kid because, I remember, when I started training at Modern Pentathlon, after I finished this competition, I had missed most of my targets on rifle. The only way I got any of my fencing points was I would just hold my arm out straight, and I figured people would eventually run into me, which they did. They got impatient. They would just run into me.
You're like the ultimate improviser. You know what's fascinating about this?
That's how you win.
Yeah, no, actually, that's very true. I fenced in college. I want to talk to you about that in a little bit.
I
love
too.
It. In fact,
yeah.
Okay, there you go. I did it in class. I didn't compete. I'm not athletic at all. This is why I do radio and play music. You know, I can do guitar playing, but sports, no. I do it for fun. But what it sounds like is that winning, you've never mentioned the word winning once. And so for you, it's just the joy of doing it. It's not, you don't have to win. You're not obsessed with winning. And even if you miss all your targets, as long as you're in there doing it, you don't care. And that's a great attitude for shooting for people.
Well, that was just the first competition because I didn't hit most of my targets on the first competition. The only points I got for fencing was keeping my arm out straight because we fenced épée, since you're a little more familiar with fencing.
Oh, yeah,
I know épée.
That's my favorite. Yeah.
Full body yep. contact. Mm-hmm. And then swimming, I swim 175 yards out of the 200 and stood up at the end of the pool, looked at my parents and shook my head like, heck no, this is not happening. I cried through the entire run. I cried. Oh. I bawled my eyes out. I was a dancer. I had never run more than like from here across the stage, you know, and here I am running cross country at a mile and a half and with girls that do this stuff, that was awful. And then, but I got to horseback ride. And so when I was done, my parents were like, oh, well, how was it? They figured I would say, not doing this ever again. And I said, it was great. And so the coaches, I don't think I was last in the competition either. So their coaches introduced me to my coach, Yana Wojcinski, out of New Mexico Military Institute. And so my mom and I would drive over there every weekend for fencing and shooting lessons. And then I would go to their summer camp for 2 or 3 weeks and where we would do 5 sports a day. It was all juniors. So from the ages of 12 to 21, I think. And we would stay in the barracks. We would have 5 sports a day, all eat in the mess hall together. And so then I became competitive. Then I wanted to qualify. Then it became about winning and it became about, you know, equipment and training and stuff. So,
Since then you've come a long way because you have some podium finishes in different competitions, right? And now you're involved in physical games and...
Yeah. Well, so I got into shooting when I was 18. I was graduating from high school, and they were taking modern pentathlon out of the Olympics. It had yet been to be in the Olympics for women at this time. It was only a male sport. And so our coaches at the time were like, you know, it would be – you guys need to go get an education. But what we recommend is that you go into some of your stronger sports. And then when you graduate from college, depending on what the USOC decides or the IOC decides, International Olympic Committee on the sport, that way you don't waste your time. And so I actually went into shooting because I excelled at shooting. So I made the I qualified for Junior Olympics, made the Junior Olympic team, won Junior Olympics in my second year, and then 2 years later, made the world championship team when I was a freshman in college. And I fenced through college at Notre Dame as well. So that's kind of how that whole happened. But then I joined the firearms industry after graduation to give back. So I'm a director of marketing for high-vis shooting systems now. Now I've dabbled in 3-gun and USPSA and shotgun sports. I do those recreationally because I've told myself I wouldn't train as hard as I had growing up. I just truly wanted to enjoy it. But then a couple of years ago, 2019, some friends called me up and I've been doing CrossFit for years. And they said, hey, there's a competition that deals with CrossFit and shooting, and it would be perfect. You should come join us. And so a bunch of 3-gunners.
You said yes, of course.
Yeah, I did, of course.
I'm just teasing you.
Oh, why wouldn't I? Sounds
yeah, exactly.
Like a miserable time. No, I'm just kidding. It was actually, yes, a bunch of, there were, I think, 16 of us three gunners who went and crashed this tactical competition for, like, military, you know, so it's based on law enforcement military, and we're like, sure, we can shoot, we'll show up. So anyways, we did it, had a great time, and in that competition, I literally, I was not doing well, and it was the first tactical games, so just in case people didn't follow, but so I actually was not doing well in this competition. I think the first event we had to do a sandbag carry, a rope climb, shoot rifle, shoot pistol, run to a shoot house. You had to memorize your target because as soon as the time started, they showed you a target. So you had to clear a shoot house. You had to engage your target in the shoot house. And then at the end of the shoot house, they had you had to take a test on what things that you saw in the shoot house. And if you didn't get the right answer on the last question, you had to stand there for 60 seconds before they'd let you move on. And then it was another, then we had to reverse it. Then it was a sandbag carry. It was shoot rifle, shoot pistol, rope climb, sandbag carry to the finish line. So it was things like that. But I think second or third event in, I was like, I'm doing terrible. I was finishing last. I was like, I didn't quite understand what was going on. I'm like, I'm not the fittest person out there, and I'm not the greatest shooter out there, but I'm average at both. I figured I'd do a little better. Long story short, I bawled my eyes out after, I think, the third event. I was going to quit, and I told myself, you know what, just finish this one event. You'll never have to do it again. So I ended up finishing all of the events, and when it came down to it, I actually tied for first place, and I ended up winning because I had more hits on target. So it was the greatest thing ever after that. And
wow, that just, you know, you just don't give up. That's kind of like what I get out of the whole moral of your story right there. Just never give up and just keep going. That's pretty awesome.
Well, it doesn't come without a struggle. It doesn't come without failure, because that's the thing is, I think, once anybody gets a taste of winning, you kind of get that, you get a hunger for it. And so it becomes a little harder to kind of say, oh, I mean, not that I expected to walk in and win this thing, but I definitely expected to. I thought I would do better. What I didn't understand was that I was going slower because I was hitting my target, whereas the other girls were just they were more so just shooting as fast as they could, thinking it was overall time. So in the tactical games, the first person across the finish line is not necessarily the one who wins, because hits on target matter. Every miss is 10 seconds on the clock. So somebody can shoot real fast and do really well at fitness, but if they don't get their hits on target, you know, but that was the thing I wasn't understanding. And so, you know, for me, once you get a taste of success, but then also kind of when you have expectations of yourself and you're not meeting them, it can be a little tough. So I didn't go through it just, you know, easily, and nothing that I've ever done. Like I said, you know, I cried through the run on my very first modern pentathlon thing. I stood up halfway through the swim and said, heck no, this isn't happening. It's kind of the same thing. It's the road to success is never, and the road to the podium is never as smooth as it seems. I think, and that's kind of in life too, is like you see really successful people and they make it look easy, but what you don't see, and essentially what social media doesn't allow us to provide anymore, is the rough road to get there. I mean, surely you're the same way. Greg, I'm sure you're the same
way.
Yeah,
I started Action
as
Radio
as
in 2014.
You
know, so yeah, exactly. But I enjoy the struggle. I enjoy the challenge.
Exactly.
You know, but I understood going into this.
It makes success sweeter, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I understood going into this that, you know, I was going to go bankrupt and I was going to have challenges and everybody was going to call me an idiot for proposing a citizen legislature with a radio show. I understood all that. because I was old enough when I started this to understand that that is exactly what was going to happen. And it's all happened exactly as I planned and all, you know, or exactly as I expected. And the things that I planned to happen, they took longer, but they're getting there. We're moving our way up the chain. Mm-hmm. We're getting bigger and bigger public figures on the show. And pretty soon we're going to explode on the scene in a way that nobody could possibly have anticipated, who thought we were going to fail. And it's like, okay, I knew this was going to happen. I just didn't know when, but the work, as long as you don't give up the work. But what you've really proved, something else too, and something that I find, I am not naturally really talented at anything, but I work harder than anybody else. And so when it came to, mm-hmm. to fencing or music or, you know, playing guitar, it took me like 40 years to get good at the guitar. Okay, now I'm pretty good, you know, but I didn't mind putting the 40 years to get here. And the same thing with you.
Right.
You're not naturally, the fact that you've had so many struggles, you know, early on the competition, they didn't look at you and go, oh, you're a prodigy. You're going to be perfect at this. You're going to go right to the top day one. No. But what you proved is that hard work, you know, can overcome, you know, whatever, you know, some people do have natural talent they don't develop, but a lot of people don't have natural talent. But if you work hard enough, you get that talent. And that's something that's really important for people, for everything, for shooting, for business, for everything. Tess?
I agree. And I think it's not just about the hard work, because I would say I'm average or a little above average in the things that I do. But it's not just about the hard work. It's about being willing to show up consistently. Because like I tell everybody, I said, I'm not the best athlete out there. I'm not the best shooter out there. I'm not the best marketer out there. But I'm the one who shows up consistently. And so, and that's the thing, is that I was the best one who showed up that day. And that's why I have so many, that's how I have so many, you know, you just have to be the best one that shows up that day. And so that whole thing about like winning your day. Go ahead.
No, and kind of going from what you jumped in there, you tried something new. And for anyone that might not have an idea what tactical games is, as we've talked about them, it's a lot of physical. It's a lot more physical than three gun. You're actually doing a lot more physical activities, and then you're doing the firearms portion of it. But after you competed that first time, how did that change your thinking, and how did that change your training? I mean, you've done CrossFit before. Did you change, train for the next event? Because I know you've been competing regularly on that, and also now you run classes on that, correct?
I do, right, yes. So for me, the tactical games actually was more of a natural fit than I anticipated. The tactical games was started by a gentleman named Tim Burke, and he was from the Special Forces community and was retired and kind of came up with the program to help he and his buddies stay up on their physical fitness, because a bunch of them were still contracting and stuff. And so it was kind of a way for them, whenever they left the military and law enforcement, because that's a hard part for a lot of these guys whenever they're still in the field, but they don't have the camaraderie and they don't have the fitness tests and they don't have the things that, you know, being in the military or law enforcement provided. So this was kind of their way to test their skills. So it started out very military type, and law enforcement, very tactical, meaning, you know, they would do a lot of memorization, they would do shoot houses, they would do just more things that you don't see in the shooting sports. And so for me, while modern pentathlon was five separate events, I trained in the military environments. I was never in the military, but I trained at New Mexico Military Institute. I was recruited to go to school there when I was in eighth grade to train for the Olympics. My parents said no.
See, that's too bad, because you wouldn't have said no. You wouldn't have said no. I can tell right now.
Oh, I was all about it. But my dad, and I understand why. My dad had just gotten his PhD, had just moved back home because he had lived away for years going to school. And so my mom was like, no, you know, I'm not going to have two ships passing in the night. We need to have a family in the household 24/7. So good on her. And I'm glad I did. I'm glad I think both of my parents are amazing. But at the same time, I do sometimes wonder, but you know, who knows, given that modern pentathlon was not in the Olympics yet for women, that was a big risk. So anyways, tactical games actually has, it fit with what I had been training for. You know, I had always been training breathing for shooting. I had always been training more high risk or not high risk, sorry, high heart rate type events. And as part of our training for pentathlon, they would have us go out and do summer biathlons. So, and, you know, we were always playing capture the flag and all kinds of different things, but everything was fitness related and everything was multi-sport. So for me, whenever I came to the tactical games, shooting with a high heart rate was not a big deal. I kind of already knew how to do it naturally, just kind of fell into it, but I didn't realize I was using the training I had had prior to, you know, starting three gun and everything like that. So for me, I don't think it was much more. I didn't have to change my training much. It was more so of just reminding myself of what I used to do. And the way that I go about tactical games and competition is kind of how I train too. So tactical games is fitness and firearms combined. But the thing is, you can't worry about the shooting if you can't get there. So you have to focus on the fitness first. So I kind of essentially eat the elephant, you know, one bite at a time. So I focus on fitness. And then once I get to the firing line, I take a few deep breaths, lower my heart rate. Then I focus on shooting, and my shooting is one shot at a time. I don't think about the string of 10 because every shot missed is 10 seconds on the clock. Well, on a 50-yard range, it's very difficult. Even Usain Bolt, the fastest runner in the world, couldn't make up 10 seconds on a 50-yard range as fast as we think we can, right? So two misses is 20 seconds on the clock. So I focus on one shot at a time because I understand that's where I can make up time, but I can't give it up there. Once that's done, then I go back and I focus on fitness. So in my training, I do the same. A lot of people try to train both together, but they don't have the experience of multi-sports. So I do my fitness separate from my shooting, and that has actually really helped me excel. Would I recommend it for everybody based on their experience? No, but it's what works well for me.
So yep. In your classes that you run for the tactical training, don't you have women's classes? I thought I saw you post on that.
Yeah, I do both.
Okay, so do you, when you're training these people in the classes, are you incorporating the physical portion of it just to give them a taste for what to expect and how to train for it? Because it seems like that would be a long-term training. If you're, you know, you go to the gym, you get the physical part, you get trained, you run. So you can't really do it in however many hours your class is. So how do you incorporate all that into a class format?
So through the Tactical Games University, first off, I do have women-specific courses, but then we also, like I'm running one that's open for anybody in coming up July 30th through 31st in Panthera, West Virginia. What I pretty much do is I incorporate everything. The course is designed to help people from the fitness community get into the shooting sports, but also to help the people from the professional communities, from military law enforcement, get into the shooting sports, but then also help competitive shooters get into the fitness world. So it is kind of a combination of both. When I go to specific ranges, like if I'm down at Austin where our kind of tactical games headquarters are and I have access to more equipment, I will incorporate more of the fitness into it. But the way that I do it is we do a lot more fun stuff. So it's like kind of like your normal training course. We discuss fundamentals. We discuss equipment. I discuss kind of like programming fit nutrition briefly because nutrition's so individualized. And then we talk about just different positional shooting and then how it pertains to the tactical games, like breathing and stuff. But when we do the live fire portion, where a lot of other firearms courses have you just stand on the firing line and work on the fundamentals, You start 15, 20 yards behind the firing line, and you will run up to the firing line, and then you will practice the fundamentals. You will show, unload, show clear, place the firearm in its desired position, and then you will run back. So every drill, we do a lot of running. I also incorporate burpee penalties based on specific things, and this is more of a fun thing rather than – But we do
You're going to have to explain
burpees.
That
so
one here.
Thing, okay.
So
burpee penalties?
a burpee penalty. So a burpee is a movement that every person in fitness loves to hate. It is a kind of more of a gymnastics but cardiovascular type movement. Essentially, it is you from a standing position, you place your hands on the ground, you throw your feet out behind you into a position, you do a push-up or just fall to the ground, and then you jump your feet back up behind your hands, and then you jump off the ground and clap your hands over your head. And it was designed, I can't remember the history of it, but it's got a cool history, but a lot of fitness people use it kind of as a measure of fitness because you can stay in one place, doesn't require equipment. So if you guys, one of the best fitness tests is just see how many burpees you can do in 60 seconds.
How many can you do?
It will.
Tess, how many can you do?
Oh, I can't remember.
Sure.
I think now it's probably like 15. It's not very
okay,
many.
Okay, no, I'm just curious. Okay.
Yeah, it's not very many. I also try to avoid burpees these days. But anyways, in my class, what we do is I try to give those as kind of a if I put a challenge out there and not everybody does it, we get 5 penalties as a class. Or 5 burpee penalties as a class. But then what I say, okay, if everybody goes up there and nobody misses, right, to like kind of put some of the pressure back in, I'll take 5 off. So, but it's a class. It's a cumulative thing. So everybody wants to do well because nobody wants to be the one person who missed. And then at the end of the day, we just have fun and we do them together nice and slow, kind of as a cool down camaraderie thing. But the second day of the course, I actually do, the athletes do get to do a battle. And if time will allow, they do 2. So one will typically incorporate some type of fitness implement, meaning sandbag, tire, like I said, whatever the range provides, because it's very difficult for me. I don't travel with a trailer, so it's very difficult for me to fly with too much weighted stuff, but sandbags work pretty well.
Your level, when you're doing these classes, your levels of your student, this person could be physically fit, never shot. This person could have shot and is not really physically fit. So you have – there's no length, no experience level, correct? So you're training at different levels.
And that – yes. And that – you know, that's a – it's a challenge for me as an instructor because you're right. I do have people who have come in and done – they've had 15 years of three-gun experience, but they're new to the fitness. They've never – and they've never shot with their heart rate that high because in three-gun – you know, or USPSA, you'll typically have between 120 and 180 seconds to shoot a course of fire. Well, that's your heart rate's not going to be elevated more than 3 minutes. In tactical games, our battles can go anywhere from 30 seconds or 3 minutes all the way up to 2 hours. So you're running and shooting and everything for a lot more than 180 seconds. And so that's something that's completely different, you know, learning how to breathe, learning when to breathe when you're shooting. Because when we're doing fitness and shooting, the one thing that people kind of don't really think about is the buildup of lactic acid. Because you're doing a fitness implement, a fitness element, and then you go to the firing line, and what do we do when we shoot?
You stand there on your board. Yeah.
I got
a big question for you here too. I got a big question because this is, you talked about earlier the scenario of basically the cavalry officer with the horse and the sword and the swimming and everything else. There's another scenario here too that's really interesting. Either a law enforcement search warrant being served to a dangerous person, you know, clearing a room, elevated heart rate, you know, accuracy with shooting. And if you're not accurate in your shooting, it doesn't matter how fast you shoot, you could be dead. You know, and the other thing is any type of life-threatening event. You know, if you have a life-threatening event, the first thing that's going to happen is your adrenaline is going to spike and your heartbeat's going to peak. And if your only shooting is calmly sitting at a target range with paper facing you, that's not realistic. That's not realistic training. So I see in every one of these events some really realistic and useful skills that you're using and putting you in a place where, yeah, you're training with an elevated heart rate, but that's going to happen anyway. And so to be, you know, I would think that every shooter, every person who wants to take self-defense seriously should go through some kind of elevated heart rate training, some kind of stress training, some kind of scenario-based training like you're doing, whether for competition or just an actual class in, you know, realistic life-threatening training. So I can see all kinds of applications for this.
Absolutely. Yes. You know, and that's just adding fitness to any type of training. You know, you're going to respond better. The more you expose yourself to stressful situations, and in terms of stressful situations, I don't mean like go out and get yourself into some trouble. What I mean is, you know, like,
well, you probably say yes to that too. Like, we don't know what trouble you've gotten into.
I don't know.
We'll save those stories.
As I'm getting older, I'm getting wiser. Just say
I'm
yes
getting
to
more
the fun
fearless.
Stuff.
I'm going just the other way. So, like I say, yeah. I want my own jet. I want to do aerobatics over the Gulf. I mean, that's all kinds of things I got planned for myself.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, sounds very fun. That sounds fun. So, but the more you expose yourself to stress, your definition changes, right? So, for stress meaning, let's say that I wanted to start running, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the very first day I go out, I run a mile. Well, that could be extremely stressful for my body, right? I could have completely expended my energy because I haven't run in 5 years. And that could literally feel like a marathon to me. Well, if I keep running a mile, that eventually gets better. So my definition of what was extremely stressful that first day becomes less, and a mile doesn't become a big deal. So then I add 2 miles. Well, now 2 miles is my stress level, my threshold. Well, then as the more I do that, the more that becomes less. So how this pertains to, you know, the tactile games, but also any type of professional activity or law enforcement or personal defense situation, as you were saying, is that the more you expose yourself to stress, your definition of it changes and your body learns how to respond better. The first time I ever competed in a tactical game, any three gunner or any person starting competitive shooting can understand this too. The very first time that you heard that buzzer goes off, right? The world starts flying by, and really it's not moving very fast and you're moving really slow because you're trying to remember everything, right? But that time goes by really quickly. Well, as you do it more and more and more, all of a sudden, you know, you're hitting the par time. All of a sudden, you're hitting half par time. All of a sudden, you're hitting all your targets. So that level, the definition of stress becomes less. And so I think it is very important for people who are in professions that are required to stress to continue to test themselves outside of their profession in order to change the definition of stress for themselves. Because as you were saying, Greg, they will respond better when they're presented with a true situation that does require them to react and be present and think. And the hardest thing, I think, is whenever you're in a stressful situation is to get your brain and body to connect. And that's where physical – I just did a talk the other day on the importance of fitness and shooting. And there's 10 general physical skills that fitness is measured on. The last four essentially are based on neurological type training. And what that means is it's how your mind and your body connect. And that really applies to competitive shooting. It also applies to any type of, you know, first responder response. I mean, even being a parent, you know, I mean, whenever you need to actually have brain-body connection and your child, you need to keep your children safe or whatever. I don't chase them around. I don't know. So there's a lot of crossover in these things.
Well, my closest experience, I used to be a flight instructor. And in fact, I'm thinking of getting involved again as the show grows and I can get back into it. But I used to stress every student out to the breaking point. And they knew it was going to happen. I told them it was going to happen. It wasn't a big surprise. I said, but I want to know what you can do. And I want you to know what you can do. So I just kind of lop on things, you know, and like pull the throttle, you know, we'd be descending, you know, it's like, where's the airplane? I'd take out systems, you know, just, you know, turn things off and eventually overload them. And it was fascinating to see everybody has a different level, but it's more how the people handle it. Those that kind of said, okay, I'm going to do this, you know, and don't get overwhelmed. It's such a mental thing that stresses. There's such a huge mental component to it that if you can keep your head, you're going to be able to solve most of the things, which leads to my next question. Have you tried aerobatics yet? Because it sounds like you would be a great aerobatics competitor. Just a thought.
No, I've skydived once, but that's about it.
Okay. All right. I think you need to take a flying lesson. I really do. I think you'd find it fascinating.
Really? I don't know.
Yeah, really? Shirley?
You need to give her a horseback riding at the end of it, though. Then she'll do it.
Well, yeah, but
just tell me I can ride a horse.
Okay, so if there's a
horse
at the end of the runway, you'll go for it. You leap out of your airplane, hop on your horse,
and stable.
Yeah, well, put a landing field beside the barn. I mean, you know, anything's possible.
Right.
But and the only other thing I had, because we're short on time here, unless you want to stay longer, we'd have nobody in the next half hour. So that's where Derek usually goes. But we rearranged this morning.
Completely
so
up
he
to
was,
you.
Yeah. Oh no, stick around. This is fun. But the only thing you're missing. Well, great. And the thing you're missing, I think, is kickboxing, some kind of martial art. You know, so if you've got the shooting, you've got the physical, you've got the sword fighting. If you could do like a kickboxing, fencing, shooting, that'd be a great triathlon event, I think. Has that ever been thought of?
Sounds exhausting, but yes.
Well, I didn't say it was easy.
I've tried martial arts a little bit. I can't say I've dabbled in it, but I have taken a couple of classes.
Okay.
And that stuff is really hard. That stuff is really tough. I have a lot
challenge.
Of respect for people who do martial arts and all that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but if you put
stuff,
on the boxing
yeah.
gloves, and then you put on the fencing glove, and then you put on the shooting gloves, you know, it's a three-glove event. You can do it.
I'm not sure. I'm not really a contact sport person.
Okay,
Everything I've done is non-contact.
Well, let's ask Shirley. Well, fencing is contact. Unless you're just holding your arm out.
From a distance.
Yes.
From a distance.
Sounds good, yeah. She just held her arm out there.
Greg, my favorite move in fencing is the flesh. So that tells you how much I like distance.
Oh, yeah. That's a leap for those that is. Yeah, go ahead.
The flesh, essentially, there's, you know, a couple of movements. There's the advance, moving forward, the retreat, moving backwards. There's a lunge, which, you know, you see a lot. And then the flesh is essentially, there's like blast throws, all kind of stuff. But the flesh is essentially where you just kind of, you're in a standing position, and then you extend your arm and you just kind of fall into your opponent. But it's more of an explosive type lunge. Where instead of lunging onto the front leg, you lunge as far as you possibly can, and then you kind of run towards your opponent.
Yeah, you're sort of committed when
kind
you
of
do
probably
that, though. That's the only problem.
Probably you are, but I was extremely sick. That was my signature move.
Ooh. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I fenced FA until my senior year in college, and then I switched to foil, and even in foil, that was my saving grace.
Oh my goodness!
When I got behind, people knew. Here she comes.
Well, it's a brave, bold action. Actually, it's right in character with you. But see, now I'm different. I'm more the strategic because I'm not the fastest person. So, but I was incredibly fast at a repost. So that was my signature move.
Oh yeah.
Repost.
Okay.
Repost is where the person does an attack, which I parry. In other words, you move the other person's blade. But I was so lightning fast at reposting that that's where I got most of my points. So they would attack me, and I would parry, and immediately, because in other words, to attack, you have to get close enough to get hit, and they would never recover fast enough. And that's usually where I got my points. A quick
nice.
Carry and boom, right there.
Yep.
Okay, and, I got a question, Tess. Since you have dance background.
Yes.
You said your mom was an instructor. So don't you think that helped you in your fencing? Isn't like that move that you kind of like? Isn't that kind of like
good
a
question.
Dance move where you kind of
like
fall into the move?
I think my dance background did help with a lot. It helped with horseback riding, specifically with balance and everything. It helped with shooting, with balance and coordination. And of course for fencing, you know, I was used to lunging. I was used to balancing, and I was used to kind of, changing direction frequently. 'Cause in dance, you know, they'll change directions. But you also, in order to do that, you have to understand where your center of gravity is. And a lot of people, I think that's a struggle for a lot of people who haven't grown up in a sport like soccer or dance or any sport, I think, as a child, is just kind of understanding where your body is in space, time and space. And so it did help a lot because fencing is kind of the dance of sport. And so, yeah, I would say it did.
Okay, I want to hear a little more about fitness and shooting, how you tie the two together. I mean, it is physical, but, and also you were also involved in injury prevention from what I read in your bio.
because I know in shooting you can get a lot of shoulder issues depending on shooting shotgun, if you're doing it properly and all that.
Right. Well, so that's kind of one of my things that's kind of taught me, and one thing that I'm kind of branching out in, and because I just feel like it, my background ties together with it, is when I was doing going from modern pentathlon to shooting, they would give us a weight training program, right? But the weight training programs for shooting were more of just like, oh, okay, we'll hold this weight up, and if you want to train the other side, just hold the weight up in the other hand to counterbalance the lifting of the gun, which is probably five pounds, 500 times. Well, if you multiply 5 pounds times 500 lifts, that's actually a significant amount of weight moved. And that's, I think, what people don't understand. So when I was in the shooting program, I actually used to tell the people at the Olympic Training Center when I was there that I was trying to get back into pentathlon so that they would give me an actual strength training program with cardiovascular endurance training, with weight training, with things like that. Because what I understood is that while I'm not looking to bulk muscle, right? In shooting, you don't necessarily want to have big bulky muscles unless you're a bodybuilder or whatever. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just that that doesn't necessarily serve the whole purpose. You don't have to have a ton of it to get the benefits of fitness. But there's a couple things that happen. One, having better cardiovascular endurance actually helps with oxygen transfer, and oxygen transfer throughout the entire body is extremely, extremely important, specifically with your eyes. Your eyes require oxygen to see the sights correctly, and the minute that you begin to deplete that, or you don't transfer oxygen correctly, and you put yourself into a stressful situation, be it the timer goes off on a three-gun match, or you find yourself in a self-defense situation, you want to make sure that that your body is transferring oxygen to the important places, such as your brain and your eyes, and that you are breathing. A lot of people kind of seize up too whenever they get into stressful situations, and they don't breathe fully through their lungs and diaphragm. They start shallow breathing, which also then depletes oxygen. So cardiovascular endurance, the strength training actually helps too, because the more muscle you have, the more capillaries you have, the more transfer of oxygen that you can get through. And so that's kind of also with the body balance, as far as you're saying, Shirley, shooters typically only shoot one position. Every now and then we'll get tested with the opposite position, but we're more comfortable with our dominant side. And so that leads to imbalances in muscles. And the older we get, the worse that gets. It leads to tendonitis and things like that. So having the muscles to be able to handle the number of lifts that you're going to do, because like I said, you are accumulating weight over time. And I think that's something that people discount, is it may be a 5 pound pistol or a 3 pound pistol, but if you lift it 200 times, that's not 3 pounds anymore, under a short amount of time. If you go hunting, such as if you go dove hunting in Argentina or something where they shoot 500s of rounds for shotgun, over a couple of days, that is actually something that is important to train for. So having better body balance and having the muscles to support the sport that you're choosing to do actually helps the tendons and ligaments and things like that, and also just kind of helps you. You'll be able to get into better positions. You'll have better balance, better agility, be able to move better on the field. So there's a lot that comes into fitness, into play, and a lot of it can be injury prevention for shooters.
I think you're right. A lot of people don't realize, you're picking up that firearm. It has a little weight to it, and you account how many times you pick it up, whether it's a rifle or a shotgun as well. I know as I get older, I get more aches and pains.
Right.
I've gone through 2 hip surgeries in the past year, so it's like, trying to get back into the swing thing and the shape so that you can compete again. And you're exactly right. Well, I remember my first competition when that buzzer went off, I was like, what am I supposed to do? Because, I had the whole play in my mind. Okay, I got it. And the buzzer went off, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. I don't know. It just went out of my head.
But it is helpful.
The monkeys throw the game plan away. The monkeys in your head throw the game plan away.
Exactly. And the first time I did, I was like, oh, this sucks. I can't do this. And then to kind of put in your mind, some shooters that I've talked to and I've walked stages with, when you walk a stage, you figure out how you're going to hit your targets and where you're going to run from here to there. And they can memorize it like that. And I'm like, damn, I'm too old for this. I can't remember that. So it is very
I'm laughing hysterically. Every time you two mention being too old, I'm just cracking up. And Pianchi's cracking up even more. This is funny.
Oh, yeah, he didn't even type in today. What's he doing back
Oh, he's there.
There.
He's there listening. Pianchi, you want to join the conversation here and introduce yourself to Tess?
Oh, my side is hurting from laughing. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I got a new question. I don't know, Shirley, where you are on your questions, but I've got something different you want to.
No, I was just going to ask Pianchi if he's ready to start fencing.
Yeah, Pianchi, you going to fence? Let's do it, dude.
No, I'm okay. I'm visualizing people. I'm visualizing people rolling around on the ground and firing all of a sudden, doing burpees and so forth. But hey, that's what it takes.
Well, no, I think we've got a real future here with the burpee, kickbox, fencing, horseback riding, swimming, shooting event. There's some potential here. Yeah. Well, here's the thing. We're Americans. We're innovators. We do strange stuff. You could probably start or maybe your company. I want to ask about gun sights in a second, because I think that's an underrepresented topic on our show. But the idea that maybe your company and other shooting companies could get together and create a new event that was a fencing, kickboxing, shooting event, or whatever you wanted to do. Let's see, shooting's boring if you just go to the range and shoot paper. And it's not realistic. I don't know how to get more people involved, but a lot of folks don't want to compete because it's competition. I don't want to spend all the time and the money. And quite frankly, a lot of competitions take too long because you've got to drive there. You got to wait. You do your event you've got to wait, 45 minutes for your 20 second event. And a lot of people can't do that. So I want to see if there's ways we can make ranges more fun, for more people. But there's no reason why maybe your company and other companies couldn't sponsor something innovative, like create a brand new sport. Yeah, it might be kind of fun.
That's kind of the tactical games is the newest shooting sport, and it could be fun, but it also takes a while, and that's kind of a
So what are the events again? What are the events again for tactical?
For tactical games, they're unknown, but we shoot rifle and pistol, so you just kind of show up and you don't know what you're going to be tested on.
Ooh,
the
I love
that
it.
Yeah, and so there's no quote events necessarily. And since the tactical games has since been purchased by a gentleman named Jared Halbert, and in doing so, we were taking a look at scoring and standards and things like that. So the sport has evolved over time, and it has become more fitness oriented rather than tactical per se. The hard time we were having with tactical is that it's very difficult to measure life type situations. So we've had to bring it more as the sport has grown, we've brought it more into the fitness realm, which has also made it much more spectator friendly. We actually do have a lot of spectators who come out to the tactical games.
Yeah, I was wondering how to do that. We had Chappie, Donnie Chapman, who used to come in all the shooting events, and once we got that pretty much covered, we sort of moved on different reports here. But yeah, that's something to get, more people more involved. And again, drones, spectator stuff, there's all kinds of ways to do it. That I think are going to be fascinating. But, anything to make this more of an interesting spectator thing, I think is going to be great, especially because, like I say, shooting paper gets boring. So let's get more people involved. I got a question on your company, because I looked them up, and they're optical sights. And I think people don't, especially new shooters, don't think about, something as visible as this. And, it's just the technology has changed so much in guns that if you have an old iron sight or a bad sight, you might be not being able to shoot simply because your sights aren't good, and you might not know it unless you've been able to see these wonderful optical things. And I'm going to put optical stuff on all my guns, and I have on the ones that I use for competition just because it's better. So how much of a role did that play? And do you remember the transition from traditional black sites to these ones that shine in the sunlight and just, you just see them pop right up in your eyes?
It's funny because like in the Olympic program, we use site black. We want our sites as black as they can possibly be.
Okay.
You don't want any white, you don't want anything like that. But whenever I started working for the firearms industry, I was kind of introduced to combat sites and, things for personal defense and just different ways that sites present themselves. So that was my first, my first experience. I mean, I still shoot what they call combat sites, essentially on my FNS that I shoot for mm-hmm. tactical games. But with Hi-Vis shooting systems, we specialize in fiber optic and tritium fiber optic sights for rifles, pistols, and shotguns. And some things that make us unique are we have a interlocking light pipe system where most other fiber optic sights, which are not 24-hour sights, those are just your daytime sights, but most other fiber optic sights, you have to kind of put the fiber in there, cut it, and melt it into place.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our light pipe system has an interlocking system, so you will receive a kit with three different colors of light pipes. And what this will allow you to do is this kit has a key on it, so you use the key to pop the light pipe out, put that light pipe back in the kit, you pull out the color that you want based on the lighting or where you're shooting, and you pop it into the sight. You shoot it if you're outside and, the lighting changes a few minutes later, or for shotgun specifically, if you go to a stage where there's a bright green background and you don't feel like you can see your green fiber optic and you'd prefer orange, you just pop that light pipe out, put it in the carry case, put the orange one in, and then you shoot that stage and then you move to the next one and you can put a white one in. You can change it. So the light pipe system allows you to be adaptive to your environment. But then we also make tritium fiber optic sights, which are 24-hour sights. They have a tritium rod inside of a light pipe.
Yeah. What is tritium?
They illuminate, yeah.
I'm just curious. Yeah, what's tritium?
Tritium is it's an element. It's a radioactive element, essentially, but it's not really radioactive. I think there's less radioactivity in that than there is in a banana in the pipes that we use.
Or like sunshine.
So
it's
not,
yeah.
It's still a government regulated item.
So, okay. I was just curious.
But what we do is, so we have a tritium lab where they're loaded into fiber optic light pipe. So the fiber optic will give you a nice bright sight during the day. And then at night, the tritium will illuminate. When the difference between glow and illuminate is glowing is typically needs to be charged by light or something like that. Whereas illumination, tritium just automatically glows naturally. So it is glowing day and night. It's just that
but you don't see it in the daytime.
During the daytime.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the fiber optic is around it. So at nighttime, for instance, if you have tritium, if you have your firearm on your nightstand or something, it's not going to be so bright that it'll affect your vision, but you will be able to see the difference between your back sight and your front sight and kind of where your handgun is. So it's just enough for you to be able to get a good sight picture and know where things are. When you need them, as opposed to most people. The funny thing is I had never really even thought about that. People think about, I bought a firearm for self-defense and everything. And it's like, well, have you ever shot it with the lights out?
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Like
no,
what might happen at
that.
Night with an invader. Yeah. It's
exactly.
Well, again, it gets back to scenarios. People don't think scenarios. They just, they're into the technology and, maybe like a gunsmithing, faster action, all kinds of other nonsense. I go with what the engineers created because they spent millions of dollars and, but the sites, and for those that don't know, the fiber optics, it's like I don't know if it's plastic or whatever the material is, but the sun kind of illuminates it. And the idea, if you're standing at the range and slowly bringing your gun up, it doesn't matter if you have fiber optics or not. But if you need to acquire the sights quickly, let me use a little gun lingo here. In other words, if you want to see your sight as quickly as possible, if it's brighter, it's easier, and so it's faster. And so that's why I find them so so helpful and handy. Yeah.
Well,
Shirley? Oh, I wanted to add cool. something to the high-vis sites because I do use them. And you can also change the back colors. So if you want it black mm-hmm. in the back and then you want the red or the green on your front sight, you can do that. Or if you want whatever works for your vision, for your eyes to acquire mm-hmm. your target. But also, I'll tell a little story about, I used to have the little fiber like you were talking about. You had to cut it. You had to lighter. You had to get mm-hmm. a lighter and you had to heat it. I never could do that. If I lost my fiber, I'd have to find some guy that, can you put my fiber back in?
Can I borrow your fiber, man? Never, yeah.
Yeah. No, I have it, but here I can't. They would do, some of them really good at it because you have to pull it. You have to heat it and pull it so the dot gets bigger. And I'm like, that's just too much for me. But high vis, you just pop them in there. It's really good. Just mm-hmm. wanted to add that little tidbit.
Thank you. Yeah, Shirley gets to hang out with us sometimes, so she's heard our spiel multiple times. I think she's given it a few times herself when we've asked her to. So.
The technology is part of the story, so this is why it's interesting to do.
Absolutely.
So where are you? Are you guys located in the same place, or are you buds? Do you go shoot together? I mean, Tess, where are you? I forgot to ask where you're even calling from.
Well, I'm out of Dallas, Texas.
Okay.
The high-vis is based out of Wyoming. But, you know, the firearms, and Shirley, I think you're in Florida?
I'm in Florida, yeah, Naples.
Yeah. The firearms, like, you know, we all kind of go to different shooting events or different trade shows together. And so really mm-hmm. the firearms industry is like one big family. So
yeah.
We've hung out in probably 10 different states or something like that, but like never in our hometowns.
And I was trying to remember when the first time I met you, and I'm like, I can't even, just like, it's just all big one family, and it's like you've always known mm-hmm. each other. I can't distinguish
yeah.
at what point, oh, this year I met Tess or I met someone else. So it's pretty,
yeah.
The shooting community, the firearms community is an awesome community to be a part of. I'm just going to add that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, and
well,
also,
like I said, Shirley has hung out at our booth a couple times at the shows, and when we got really busy, I was like, hey, can you take care of those people? She's like, sure. So, like, that's the beauty of it, too, is that we truly are, like, you know, everybody helps everybody out, and, you know, it's and when we speak to products, too, that we truly enjoy, and Shirley's mm-hmm. a great representative for the industry and for all of the organizations that she's a part of. And her story is amazing too.
Yeah.
And so we're very appreciative for people like you, both of you guys.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. We do have some bills for you if your company is able to, or you personally are able to endorse citizen legislation, which we can talk about now or later or some other time. But, you know, if you're interested, we've got the bills for you.
Okay. We'll definitely can talk about that for sure.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll give you two just off the top of my head here. There's one that takes suppressors off the National Firearm Act list, because why should you have to lose your hearing when you're defending your life? You know, so that's something mm-hmm. that as a gun tech company might be interesting, that would be something that you could offer, you know, and this is something we're pushing too, is to get this, because I've never understood this need to have the loudest possible weapon. You know, it's like, do I save my life or my hearing? You know, and that's not a choice people should have to make. Another one of our bills
right.
is Second Amendment advancements, especially for lower income folks, so they don't lose, you know, the ability to exercise their rights simply because they can't afford, you know, a decent firearm. And so we have a bill that has tax credits, tax deductions, things like that for firearms and ammo, and training and range fees and everything else like that. So it encourages people, you know, that they'll get a tax credit for, say, they purchase a decent firearm. So there's some bills. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail now. We don't have much time. I can send you the list, and you can tell me if that's something that either you, the company, or both might be interested in helping to advocate. And I'm hoping the DC Project, mm-hmm. so you guys are nonprofit though, so it's different. I don't think you can do it. But that's what we do here. You know, this is the world's only citizen legislature combined with a radio show. And so not only do we talk mm-hmm. about these issues, we offer viable solutions to them. And that's just too. I have another bill that you might be interested in that changes the background check. So it puts the prohibited people on a list with the gun retailer. So if you walk in with your driver's license, your picture ID, so, you know, it's verifiable who you are, that's compared to the prohibited list. If you're not on the prohibited list, you can buy whatever you want. That is a background check. But what it doesn't do is register you and register all your firearms with the government for future confiscation. And so there's another one. There's, in fact, Larry Pratt, when he was running Gun Owners of America before he became the emeritus person, was on my show, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. Loved that bill. And so there's something else, too, that we can change the background check. So it's just a background check. It's not a registration scheme. So all these things we have, and like I said, I don't know how political you can or want to get. I'll leave that up to you. But it's there. That option is there if you or other folks want to become more advocate and help the Second Amendment cause, you know, by actually taking a positive position instead of always being on the defensive. And so that's what we do here.
Well, that's great. That's very important for, I mean, there are so many parts in the firearms industry that's extremely, mm-hmm. extremely important. And, you know, working for a manufacturer and as an employee of a manufacturer, I can say that we're extremely grateful for all that you guys do because we all have to work together. We're all in this together. You know, mm-hmm. I don't think there's the one entity that can say, oh, that doesn't pertain to us by any means. We're just all focusing on our own items
mm-hmm.
to make it happen. So, yeah.
Well, but as an industry, from the banks that refused to give, you know, firearms manufacturers loans, I think Bank of America was doing that, to the censorship where you can't advertise on a lot of shows, you know, to all kinds of other things, you know. So I can see where firearms companies,
well,
even if you're competing,
I don't know if you
just
heard Friday, FedEx and UPS updated their firearm shipping policies. So
oh,
that's
do tell.
About
that. Yeah, well, let's go. Yeah, what happened?
Shirley, go ahead if you want to.
Shirley, do you
well,
know?
What I understood, I didn't know FedEx got on. I know UPS said they were not going to be shipping any. I don't know if it was any firearms parts or only certain ones. The story was kind of vague on that. Yeah, go ahead.
So I was actually kind of got into this because I, you know, even though I work for a manufacturer, a lot of people think, oh, you know, they have the inside track, and it's not. I'm still a civilian, still a civilian firearms owner at the end of the day. And I'm trying to get a slide worked on by a gunsmith, and he called me the other day and said, hey, so pause for a second, but. So he was the one that kind of let me know. I guess Friday they changed – I'm trying to find the verbiage. They changed the information on shipping for firearms, and pretty much what it says is that you have to ship through an FFL now. So for any gunsmithing or anything, you have to ship directly from an FFL to an FFL.
And they'll charge you for it.
Mm-hmm, your transfer fees. And so that's, yeah. It's just the, I think the thing that we were most taken aback by was the lack of communication.
Yeah.
And not that they, it's not necessarily their responsibility to reach out and tell us that. But, you know, there's, I think people would be a little more understanding if there was more communication about when things happen, as opposed to just feeling like we get blindsided by things that are decided without other things are announced throughout time, but for, you know, other industries, and we just kind of feel like for us, it's not necessarily the same.
And what
they're
doing is, on the letter that I saw that someone had posted, there's a company in Daytona, there in Daytona Beach, they have like $30,000 of parts in the midst being shipped somewhere. And they're mm-hmm. going to basically destroy those. They're not returning. They're just going to destroy them. They're not getting to who they shipped them to. They're not coming
Why
back.
Why is that?
They're just that. That's what I'm saying. I'm seeing bits and pieces of this. I don't know the whole story of. But there was a letter posted that they were telling them, "Well, we're just going to destroy them. They're not going to ship them." And I'm trying to find it right now as we're chatting.
So this is, yeah, I think this is the part of things that people are still kind of trying to figure out. What is all included? What does all of this mean? Because there are a lot of, as Shirley's saying, there are kind of bits and pieces that are trickling out. People are kind of putting information out online as they find out, but it's hard to put the whole picture together that way. I've heard multiple times that they are going to be destroying things. I have heard that it is part of a way to kind of close the ghost gun the ghost gun loop or things like that. I've heard that it stems from something a little bit more political. But
everything with guns is political. That's the problem,
right?
You know. So, so what's a ghost gun for those that don't know? We should define what that is for, because we have a lot of international listeners too that are, you know, that never get to do the things that we've talked about the last hour and a half. So it's quite fascinating. But yeah, what's a ghost gun for those that aren't sure? Anybody have a good definition?
I don't know that I have a good I understand what it is, but I'm not sure that I'm. I just know they're pretty much the guns that, you know, a lot of people kind of build on their own. They're not serialized as a whole.
Yeah, so the government can't control
them. It's my understanding.
They don't have them registered. They can't confiscate them. As far as I know, they could be 3D printed. They could be put together with different parts, but they don't have a serial number, so they're not registered. Does that make them any different than another gun? No. You know, but that's where it comes in. So they call them ghost guns. You know, it's like they used to say that the Glocks, you know, you can't tell them in airport security. They're dangerous because they're plastic. Yeah. Well, except for the metal slide and, you know, the top frame and everything else. But so it's a lot of misinformation. You know, gun show loophole, it doesn't exist. All this stuff, these buzzwords are just crazy. Bianca, yeah, what's your comment?
Well, what business FedEx don't want? You got DHL, you got UPS. And you got others that was even the U.S. Postal Service. This would be an opportunity for them to take on more business to help their viability. So FedEx, goodbye.
Well,
UPS
too.
Was
that's
the
good
one.
Point. Yeah.
UPS was the big one, though. UPS is no. You must. They're the ones that put the new stipulations into place. FedEx has been kind of stayed the same, but UPS is the big one. So you only have Postal Service or DHL.
Someone else should, I don't know how you would do this because you'd have to be located in these areas, but it may be an opportunity for yet another entity to go into business.
Exactly.
Right.
And because right now, Brownell, they told their customers on a Facebook page on Friday that they too were terminated by UPS. And I believe somewhere I saw that there's five Democratic House or Senate, I don't remember which ones they were, that are pushing to have this also go through United States Postal Service as well as FedEx, and they're asking them all to do that same, drop all firearms accounts. And,
you know, there's a discrimination here, because there was a time when the civil rights struggle was going on that you couldn't, you know, restaurants in the South that wouldn't serve black customers and hotels that wouldn't take black travelers, you know, even though they're open to the public, you know, and that becomes public accommodation. In the same way, you know, we've got a bill here that I'm working on that creates, you know, an additional category in the Civil Rights Act of gun ownership, as well as ideology, and I think there's another one we're thinking of too. But gun owners are being discriminated against all over the place. You know, it's a restraint of trade. If it's a company that's open for public accommodation, which UPS is, they ship packages. Mm-hmm. If they all of a sudden say they're not going to ship certain packages because of whatever prejudice, bigotry, or whatever they have against certain customers, that's illegal. You know,
you're
they're
absolutely
public accommodation.
Right.
And so there's a way to fight
this.
They
stop delivering. Was there a stoppage in delivering sheets and pillowcases to hotels that would not allow blacks to stay at it? Hell no.
Yeah. So there's a whole different thing here that we can work on.
And this is just you can think of this as just the beginning too, because I know when I would ship my ammo if I was doing a 3-gun competition in another state, mm-hmm. and I would ship it, and I'd ship it UPS. So if they're starting here, who knows how far they're going to go and then stop, well, we can't ship ammo, we can't do this.
Right.
And does that
when you're required to mark ammo, so it's
exactly.
got a big flag on it. Like, I know what that is.
But
so.
Is this going to affect Hi-Viz, you think? Are they going to, even though they're sites, you think that will affect them as far as, will they drop them just because they're dealing with firearms?
Anytime that we hear things like this, we look into it. Our job is to protect our company at the highest level. We're looking into this just to kind of see. So we're going to be communicating and trying to make decisions as we need to. But we're not sure that it's going to be, because they don't specifically say you know, firearms parts and accessories, because we're considered an accessory, but it all comes down to definitions. And kind of from what I'm also hearing is like the UPS department that you deal with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a company, we're going to do our due diligence to protect ourselves and protect our customers. But as of right now, we don't have any changes for us.
Well,
at the
if
time.
Your company wants to get more politically active, I know a place you can do it. us. Okay, so believe me, we got a lot of things.
Right.
In fact, I want endorsements from companies. I want companies putting this on their corporate, newsletters and stuff to customers. And not just you guys, but, you know, Amoland, the media needs to get involved. Black Rifle Coffee Company needs to get involved. All these companies need to start getting involved because we've got the legislation that can fix a lot of this. And speaking of which, I'm going to totally segue here right now. Now, Tess, I know you're busy, but you're welcome to stay. Same with Shirley and same with Bianchi. I have a new bill writer on the line. Amber Kemper has written a bill called The Protection of Rights Granted by the Constitution. It's quite fascinating. So we need to sum up here. I'm going to bring her on. I'm going to make her line live right now and see if she has any gun questions now that I got you both here. So Amber, our newest citizen legislator, welcome to the show. And do you have any gun questions or you want to wait until we get onto your bill?
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I just joined, so I don't have any specific questions relating to gun control.
Okay. Well, sounds good. Welcome to the show. Let me see if my other folks, Tess, can you stay longer or do you have to dash off and like do real work?
I should probably get to work at this point.
Okay. Well, give us a shameless
plug.
But
I have truly enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. I appreciate it. So, and I appreciate all that you guys are doing.
Well, come back more often. Tess, you know, once you're on the show, you're part of the family. So, you know, feel free. Shirley?
Well, yeah,
thank you so much for taking your time and speaking with us. It's been a pleasure learning so much more about you and everything that you've accomplished. And, yeah, good luck to you. If there's anything I can do to help
you
out, you let me know.
Okay, well, thank you. And I look forward to seeing you guys soon on the road.
Okay. Do you have any public website communication, Facebook page, anything that people can get a hold of you that you can give to, like, 70 countries right now?
On Facebook, you can look me up as Tess Salb Shooting. And on Instagram, I am shoot_4_gold. And then, of course, highvizsites.com is the company. You can find us both on Facebook and on Instagram. So just let me know if you guys have any questions.
There we go. Sounds good. And again, come on back. This is fun. Shirley,
right,
how about
I
you? Okay, well, sounds good. Okay,
thank you, guys.
All right. Take care.
There
thank
should
you
be
much.
A ban. Yeah, in these states, there should be a ban on material that's used for abortion. Forceps, gloves.
Yeah, stop transporting that stuff. Yeah, there's an interesting thought. Yeah. That's actually, we need to talk about that more on a different show. That's fascinating. I'm going to play one thing for a minute just so I can take a breath, and we're going to change topics here. But one of the things that we do that makes us unique in the world is citizen legislation, and I have a new citizen legislator who has written a bill, and I want to show everybody how this process works. It's not that tough, you know, and the fact that that Amber's going to come on the show, or is already on the show here, and be able to talk about this kind of stuff, I think is quite fascinating. So let me take a one-minute break, and I'll be right back.
Action Radio, part of the ADHD Radio Network, the ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take, that is Action Radio.
Yeah, I was just going to miss Shirley's contact information. Shirley Watchwell, you can find her at the Action Radio Gun Group on our Facebook page. She's also the Florida chapter president of DC Project, and DC Project is a women and guns project that's based out of DC and does some amazing stuff. And she's here every Friday, so you know you can call and talk to her then. So let's welcome our newest citizen legislator onto the show, Amber Kemper. Amber, good job. Nice bill. Let's talk about it. First of all, how are you doing? And what's your story? How did you hear about Action Radio and how did you come to write a bill? I'm curious.
I actually wrote this bill for an event called Patriot Academy that I was planning on attending last year at the Texas Capitol. But with Governor Abbott's special sessions, it ended up canceling it. So I had this bill, and I was like, what do I do with it? And my dad sent me Action Radio and the Write Your Laws website. And so I was like, I'll just put it on there and see what happens. And so here I am.
Exactly. Well, this is what happens. I ask you on the show.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it fun. Yeah. And so this is what you're doing is exactly why I created this, is that it just, regular person with a great idea who would never have the opportunity otherwise to get to a legislator, have them, write up your bill and put it in committee and vote on it. We're like, we're just bypassing that whole process. So we're actually writing the bills ourselves. And then we supply them to the legislature and say, here, what are you going to do with this? And so for those that want to look it up, you go to writeyourlaws.com. That's WriteYourLaws, writeyourlaws.com. And if you go to the legislation item on the menu bar, and then you click on that, and then you click citizen bill ideas, where the bills in progress are being worked on, you'll see Amber's bill, the protection of the rights granted by the Constitution. I want to talk to you about the title because it seems a little different than your actual bill, but we'll work on that. So this is our workshop. So you get to ask me questions. I'll ask you questions, anything you want to know, and I can tell you how, from here, how to advocate it, how to share it. And, we'll basically, share the link with all your friends, share the link with media, share the link with legislators you want to get this to, and then they hopefully will do that, and more folks will pick up on this bill and go, huh, I like that idea. So tell me about your bill.
So the bill is basically requiring all of our elected officials before they take office to take the United States citizenship test.
Mm-hmm.
This will require them to know the history of our nation along mm-hmm. with the Constitution.
One would think, just interrupt you for a second,
right,
one would
right.
think that people that actually run for office governing us you using the Constitution daily would have some knowledge of it, but apparently that's not the case.
Right. You would think that would be the case, but alas, it is not. So once they take the test, this bill is requiring those scores to be published online, available to all of the public. So then whenever you see, so-and-so failed the United States citizenship test, you can kind of look at that and be like, do we really want them to govern me? And hopefully for most, the answer would be no.
Yeah.
And before elections roll around, they have that opportunity to look at those scores and decide whether or not to vote for them.
Yeah, I was thinking about a lot of things when you did this, because I took the citizenship test because I was born in Canada and came to this country by way of Australia. So I'd already lived in three countries by the time I was, 12. So I'm kind of used to moving around a bit. But
yeah.
I remember the citizenship test before I was 21, and they interviewed me, and they asked if I had ever been a member of the Communist Party, having just gone through college.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no. And they said, do you ever plan to be a member of the Communist Party? I said, no. And I said, are you saying that without, with no reservation or purpose of evasion? I said, absolutely. I'm not evading I don't want anything to do with the Communist Party, and this is freedom. This is why I'm here, right? Okay, so, mm-hmm. as an adult, this is why I'm staying here. So I was pretty honest about it. And then, okay, that makes sense, yeah. And I had to memorize the Bill of Rights. And I had to learn a lot of the Constitution, at least read it and understand it. But I think I memorized the preamble and things. And they tested me on those things. And the ironic part about that is that as much as I like the country, beforehand, I really loved the country after I went through the citizenship process, because it actually taught me a bunch of things. And what I found to my disgust was that I knew more about American citizenship and the Constitution than people who were born here. And it's like, how come I know this as an immigrant, a legal immigrant, unlike what's happening today, and you folks don't? And I was rather disgusted.
Right, it's unfortunate.
So, yeah, go ahead. So what do you think so far? I'm curious. Yeah, about the citizenship.
Yeah,
test.
Yeah.
Okay.
About the citizenship test in general.
Well, just what I'm talking about here, the fact that immigrants who pass it know more than Americans.
Right. I think it really, like, when, if you take it and if you study for it, you really gain an appreciation for the country as a whole and why we have what we have in place. But, you know, like you said, a lot of Americans today can't even take it or would fail it on first try. And I sent a survey out with, like, some of the general, more general questions, citizenship tests. And I sent it to some of my friends and some people I knew. And it was maybe a 50% pass rate.
Do you remember some of the questions? Do you have the test with you? Or is it on your computer file somewhere?
Yeah, it's somewhere. But I know a couple of them were like, what were some of the 13 colonies, you know? Pretty simple question that if you've been through high school, been through school, you should be able to answer these questions.
Well, you know,
that's
right,
a
now,
good idea.
Yeah, I thought you, Bianchi's
that's
on the line.
Idea,
Bianchi,
right?
Bianchi's like my co-host here, so yeah. Go ahead, Bianchi.
That is an excellent idea. How in the heck can you swear to uphold something that you don't know anything about? And what is the question? What is the point that it was made with the Supreme Court justices when they were going to confirmation, and you got people saying that, well, you was asked the question about abortion, but you answered the question, which apparently you was deceitful. Well, the same thing can be said about politicians who give the oath to swear to uphold and defend the United States Constitution, and they don't know nothing about it.
Right.
You know, I think you should put that in the bill. Put exactly what Bianchi said, you know, right into your bill. How can you hold a constitutional office and swear an oath to the Constitution if you don't know what the Constitution says? I would put that right in your bill. So if you're taking notes or going to get the podcast later, that's the purpose of this workshop. So we're going to make a permanent record for you here to share, to have for yourself, and just have a bunch of suggestions. I would actually change your title too. This is the protection of rights granted by the Constitution. What we're really doing is protecting Americans from ignorant members of Congress. Now, I wouldn't say it like that, but I think you might want to rework that title also. What do you think?
And it shouldn't be just for new members. It should be for existing members who's running for re-election.
Yeah, I agree with that, too. Now you got two questions, Amber. So we got the title, we got the recurring. So what do you, and like I said, we're proposing amendments to you for your bill to make it better. And so if you like them, then write a comment back and see what you think. But I think those are two. Let's talk about the title first of all, then we'll talk about recurring. And you don't have to have an exact new title, but do you think that we could make that more accurate?
Yeah, like kind of relate it more to the bill itself.
Yeah, because there's always the scenario of the Affordable Care Act. Is that what the bill was? No, it was the Health Destruction Act. You know, so we like to be too honest in that. But what about Bianchi's idea of making a recurring test in Congress?
Yeah, I think I'm reading the section of the bill here. So
we're going to read section
12 months of being section 5. Yeah, within 12 months of being elected. And no more than 3 months before any primary election. All candidates, whether incumbent or new candidate, should have their exam received results no later than 3 months before the primary election. So you have to take it within 12 months of being elected. So you have to take it every year. Before you're elected, and then within a year after you're elected. And then it's pretty much whenever at that point. But for the Supreme Court justices who are there their entire life, they would only take it twice.
Well, they're not there their entire life. Let's talk about it. Here's one of the great myths, and this is be one of my questions. Do Supreme Court justices have lifetime appointments? So without describing exactly the answer, which I've pretty much given away, let me ask you, Amber, do Supreme Court justices have lifetime appointments?
It almost feels like it.
Oh, I know that, but what does the Constitution say?
Can't recall off the top of my head.
That's okay. So I want you to take your own test. That's perfectly fine. Bianchi, what are they in for? We'll get him back online.
Good behavior.
Exactly. Article 3. I'm looking for the clause right now. I think I'm in Article 1 still. Article 3, the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court. And as such, the judges, both of the Supreme and Inferior Courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior. There you go. No such thing as a lifetime appointment. And that would be one of the questions I would ask, because that is fundamental. You know, the what you're getting to here, and this is why it's so important, your bill is really important, is we say a lot on this show all the time, assumptions are stronger than truth. People assume, because they've always heard, that judges are a lifetime appointment. It's simply not true, which means judges can be recalled. Justices of the Supreme Court can be recalled, you know, at any time for bad behavior. The question is, how do you define bad behavior? And I'm not going to have that in your bill, but that's something to think about, that may be one of the questions. Right. Another issue I had with this that I wanted to talk to you about is the fact that you want it taken online and secure. And my question is, how do you make it secure so that people running for Congress don't just hire somebody to take the test for them? How do we ensure that the people running for office and in office actually
know? I can
know,
tell you how to do that.
Oh, hold on, Pianki. I want to get Amber's idea on this. That's part of my part of why I want to do this and have the bill author on. But believe me, I'll give you a chance to do it. Amber, what do you think?
Yeah, so I currently do online college, and
okay.
a lot of the things that they do for online tests is they do pretty much lockdown browsers.
What are
and
those?
In the setup for that process, so it basically locks down your entire computer and just has it to where you can only look at the test. Like, you can't go to Google, you can't go to apps, nothing.
This is new. Okay, you need to put that in the bill.
Yeah, it locks down.
You need to put that in the bill.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. No, this is good. This is why we do this. This is great. I'm I love it. I didn't know anything about this. Okay. Continue, please.
Yeah, a lot of the times there's individuals there watching what's happening while you're on the browser, while you're on the lockdown browser.
Who's watching it?
So that kind of, I honestly don't know for sure.
Okay.
It could be test administrators, could be people that work with the lockdown browser company. I don't know for sure. But it also requires you to show your ID and a picture of yourself. So, like, you have to have the ID and the picture of yourself, and it also records you, screen records you, and has your webcam.
So these people should take their test not at their home computer, but at a specific location certified to give the test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, let's put that in the bill. You're going to have a long list of things by the time we're done.
Yes.
this is going to be great. Okay, Bianca, your turn.
Yes, a certified location, the same way it is when we go take our ground school or when you take your FAA certificate for drones. It's 7. I can't think of the name. My grandson just took it. He had to go to a location, couldn't have a calculator, couldn't have a phone, got to make sure that they don't have any notes written on the palms of their hands and all that kind of stuff. So, no, make them go. Then you're putting people to work, and you also help to establish a new business. Make them go to a location where they have to take the test. In person.
Yeah, they can pay for it out of their campaign funds. Let's put that in too. Okay. Isn't this fun? I love this process. Okay. And Amber,
if they fail the test, they have to wait a month before they can retake it. They can't come in the next day. And they have to pay the fee all over again.
Well, wait a minute. If they fail the test, should their candidacy still be eligible? Should they still be eligible for the office they're running for?
Make them wait a year.
Okay,
I thought about that. And
Amber, what do you think?
The thing with the punishment is that, you know, it doesn't do much. Like, they can still run for office, they can still study for the test and still get it. But if we publish their scores online, then voters have the choice to whether or not to elect them into office.
Yep. And if you do it early enough, their opponents can highlight the score too.
Right.
So if one candidate passes the flying colors and the other candidate fails miserably, like Ilhan Omar would never get to Congress under a normal system.
Well, you also can
go ahead.
you also can bring that against them and say, yeah, you took the test 3 years in a row and failed. Now you're here trying to tell me how I should be acting.
I love it. Yep. All these things we can put in the bill. This is fascinating. So let me, here's what's good. I like the way you do this. You got a title, decent title. If we're going to work, you can work on that. And amendments for the amendments, after you've listened to the podcast, after we've given you all these suggestions, what you want to do is post a comment. And post a comment with all the changes you want to make. And that way we have a legislative record of it. It's kind of like the congressional record. So we'll see where the bill was. So copy the bill in its current form, okay? And so that you'll have a record of that. And then I may even post that as a comment. And then put a comment as of all things of the new version of how you want to change it. Pianki's done that with his bill. Pianki's written a bill. This is a good time to do that. Pianki, you want to talk about your bill to Amber?
I wrote several bills. Federal ballots and state and local ballots should be separate. Mm-hmm. And the requirements for participating with the federal ballot requires you to meet a certain vetting procedure that's spelled out, because you can't get 50 states to fall in line. You got some states like New York tried to allow illegals to vote, which was struck down by the courts, but that's one of my bills. Well, I really like hers, Grid. I mean, we can really go some places with this.
Well, that's why I wanted her on the show. You know, we're going to add this to our – I'm going to put this in my list of – once we get it in decent shape, I have a package of bills. I have 26 bills to rock 2022, and I'll add 27 once we get this one in decent shape. So it says, be enacted by the Congress of the United States. Yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Pianki.
You know what else? This can apply to school board members. They have to take the oath and show – that they know.
Ooh.
This go up and down the line, even to the trash collector.
Yeah, you can make a state and the local version of this. In fact, you can. I would do either a separate bill or have a separate section that says for states and local government. You know, just have a section that applies to them, and the states can figure out where the code is. And we want to try and find a place in the federal code where we can put this. So we're going to cite a title and section where this is going to go. We just have to find it. But for the states, because they're all different, they have all different numbering and code systems. You can just say states can do this, local governments can do this. You know, and just have an extra section or a section at the bottom. You know, for adapting to state and local government, you could write something like that. That'd be another cool thing to do. So you have a.
I mean, can you think?
Go ahead.
Make an IRS agents, you know, take these tests. Man, this is.
Ooh, wait a minute. Now you're. This is a separate bill. The federal. No, so this is what happens on the show, believe me. This is why we're so creative. This is why nobody in the world does what we do. Okay. This is absolutely brilliant. Now, Amber, we're going to draft. You thought this was going to be easy. We're just giving you 10 times more work. But I think you're up to it. I think you're up to the challenge. That's why I wanted you on the show.
Yeah, I'm down for it.
But you should look at a federal bureaucrat citizenship qualification test to be eligible for federal employment and to maintain federal employment. And because the bureaucracy is probably the biggest problem in Washington. The permanent bureaucracy, the local fiefdoms or fiefdoms that exist in these regulatory agencies. I have a bill that I'm going to work on probably tomorrow. Amber, I'm curious what you think, and Pianki, I want your opinion too. I want to write a bill that disarms the entire federal bureaucracy, because nothing in the Constitution says that any member of the bureaucracy, not military, totally separate, but no member of the executive branch of government has constitutional authorization to be armed. I want to take all their arms and all their ammunition and any related accessories and put that into the civilian marksmanship program so they can be donated back to Americans who qualify under that program. How's that for an idea? Amber?
How would that fall under the Second Amendment?
It
would. Are they still technically allowed to have personal firearms?
Second Amendment, no. The Constitution specifically, the Second Amendment is for the people. It's not for the government. It says what the government can't do, but the Second Amendment does not authorize government. This is a really great question. The Second Amendment does not authorize government people to be armed. That would be the Second Amendment in reverse. That would say the right of the government to be armed can't be touched, whereas the Second Amendment says the right of the people to keep and bear arms can't be touched. Well, the people are separate from the government. That's the whole purpose of the Constitution, is that the people through the states have authorized the federal government to do certain things. And if it's not there, the 10th Amendment says they can't do it. It's a great question. Maybe I'll incorporate that in somehow. I'll have to work on that myself. Yeah. Anyway, let me get back to your bill. An act relating to the protection of the rights granted by the Constitution. That's not exactly what you're talking about. I want you to work on that as well. Because, first of all, rights, as I understand, and most of us understand the Constitution, rights are granted by God. The Constitution is prohibited on the government touching those rights.
And so
you may want to – what you're really doing is it's an act to confirm, verify, however you want to do it, the constitutional knowledge of those running for elective office. How's that sound?
Yeah.
Okay, so think about changing it to that, and then a separate bill on the bureaucracy, I think might be in order. We're going to make you busy. Now, do you have a background in legislation? Are you in college right now? It sounded like you were. Are you taking political science, constitutional law? Are you going to be a lawyer one day? I'm curious about your background.
Yeah, so I'm 17 years old, so I just graduated high school.
Oh my God, this is wonderful! You're brilliant. I love it. This is so cool.
I thought you were much more mature than 17.
So too.
I thought we were talking to someone with mid-30s.
Wow. Let's give her a round of applause. This is great. Don't go away. I've got to give you a round of applause. Hang on. Good for you.
Thank you.
I'm impressed. I hope the law firms are listening and they're going to pay for your law school. I hope we got some people who are going to help you out here.
You know,
I'm serious.
Yeah,
one thing that we need to
debate.
Okay, Pianki first, then get back to Amber. Pianki, what's your comment?
One thing you need to understand is that your professor is going to try to teach you that the Constitution is evolving. No, it is etched in stone and it's absolute. And Greg can explain it to you.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, the Constitution is supposed to be used, not interpreted by the Supreme Court. Actually, I was thinking of something completely different. I want to offer you a regular spot on Action Radio to do a constitutional moment. Yeah, so I want you to, if you're interested, do your own research, 5-10 minutes, something like that. Just call us up each week or as you want to. But we'll see if we can figure it out. Don't do this right away. Just think about it. We'll talk later. We'll get you a time, pick a provision of the Constitution. I want to go through the whole thing. So this will take probably your entire college career. you call up and go, I got my 10 minutes on Action Radio. But just pick a different section of the Constitution, like one of the ones I would love to see highlighted with a little bit of, not a lot of background stuff because I know you're going to be busy. But Article 4, Section 4 talks about the ability of the states to declare that they're being invaded. That's what Texas is using right now. That's very important. So that would be something that we should highlight in about a 10-minute report. It says Section 4, Article 4, Section 4, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government. That alone is a report. Because everybody talks about democracy. Democracies are illegal under the Constitution. I don't know if most people don't know that, okay? And then it says, and shall protect each of them, meaning the states, against invasion. Well, the federal government's doing just the opposite. They're actually promoting an invasion. They should all be arrested. I mean, well, first of all, the Brandon insurrection should be arrested because it's a bunch of coup leaders that aren't even legitimately in office. But the second reason they should be arrested, we're talking multiple charges here, is that they're supposed to protect against invasion, not cause one.
You know, another thing, too, when you announce, when you present yourself, make sure you mention your age. Make sure you mention your age. I'm such and such. I'm 17 years of age, and my field of study is blah, blah, blah. Mention it.
Yeah. Are you going to senior year
and
this
the reason
year,
why,
or have you graduated?
And the reason why is because put adults on the spot. You're putting adults on the spot.
That's true.
Because they are not doing what they're supposed to do, and now all of a sudden you got to come along. See, they put things in place, which they really don't, that you got to live with, and you're not satisfied with what it is that you're finding one morning you wake up that you have to contend with because they didn't do the right thing.
Right.
This is fascinating. Are you going to be a senior this year, or have you already graduated high school? Where are you? You're going to be a senior, right?
I graduated in May.
So you graduated early?
Yeah.
Why does that not surprise you?
I was homeschooled kindergarten through 12th grade, and so I'm a summer birthday, so I can go either way.
Okay.
And so we just decided to start early and graduated early.
That is fascinating. I want to get your folks on the line. I want to congratulate them. They've done a great job. This is do they know you're calling? I hope they do. I'm sure they do. But
I think they do. I think they're all still asleep, though.
Well, wake them up. They should hear this live. Anyway, but I'd be, you know, they're certainly welcome on the show too, but this is fascinating because I want to promote homeschooling as much as possible. And this, I'll tell you, if, you know, you are a walking ad for homeschooling, because the fact that you've done this at 17, that you've written a bill, that you contacted me on your own. We didn't know each other. This is what you initiated, which is, I'm really happy and proud of you for doing so. But coming to us as a high school, as a 17-year-old minor, you know, you're not even that old yet. You know, have written a bill like this that most people in Congress couldn't write or wouldn't write. So you're ahead of pretty much everybody in Congress right now in terms of your constitutional knowledge, your awareness, and your activism. You know, and so congratulations to you. I think this is fabulous, and I'm really happy. I'd love you to be a part of the show on a regular basis. Think about it. Talk to your folks. See about how much time you have. But if you want to start doing constitutional moments and work your way through the entire Constitution, I mean all of it. This is a multi-year project. I'm game. Bianchi, what do you think? You want to hear from Amber every week? I do.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and this is great. You know, this can also expand to people of particular professions. Before you get your certificate honoring you or recognizing you at their profession, you have to pass this constitutional test. You have to give this oath that you would uphold and defend the United States Constitution. Children have to learn this in school in order to graduate. I mean, this is going to be great. This is how you fight back.
I'll give you another thing you might want to put into your bill. The fact that doctors, lawyers, teachers, anybody with a profession has to pass a license and a certification test. Now, we're not going to license people running for office, but the fact that all these other professions have certification tests to prove their knowledge, why shouldn't we do that for elected officials? So if anybody wants to question you, say, well, you can't do that, that's prejudicial. So wait a minute. Plumbers have to pass a test before they can plumb. Okay.
Electricians, absolutely.
Exactly. They got to pass the test.
Engineers.
So engineers. You can't build a bridge unless you've passed your civil engineering certification and probably multiple levels of certification. And your work is still checked by other people with another level, by inspectors of another level of certification. I would include that in the bill. This is going to be a bigger bill, but that's okay. Yeah. Section 1 of your bill says the United States federal government will pass legislation containing the following. I would change that. I would make the bill, make it a bill. Don't say the federal government will pass, because you're putting on more on them to write it. And what I want you to do is have as many details as yourself. And this is to encourage you. This is, you know, I'm not really criticizing, but I want to encourage you that the more you do, the less screwing around with it they will do. To say they will pass legislation, you know, they're going to get arrogant and say, well, no, we're not. You know, we're going to let this sit. And so we always say, you know, let's go for the positive. Here is the legislation we want you to pass. You know, our mission statement of the show, you know, we the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed. That is a revolutionary principle. And the rest of it says, and have the right through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. So that's equally a part of it too. So now you know our basis here. This is what we operate under, that our consent to be governed, you know, the new basis, the new, you know, and I asked this question when I started this several years ago, and I'm thinking of the Declaration of Independence, when Thomas Jefferson said, the just powers of government come from the consent of the governed. Well, how do we give our consent? You know, Kristi Noem, who I have deep respect for, but I completely disagree with her on this, said you give your consent on election day. Well, what about the other 364 days of the year? You know, government's operating all the time. How can we only give consent on one day? And I thought, well, okay, well, let's do something different. Let's give our consent by writing the laws that we consent to be governed by and supplying them directly to the people who are governing us, so that we are the source of their legislation, not the lobbyists, the corporations, the George Soros, the people like that.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
And you know what else?
Go for it.
You and your associates can begin a publishing company to write this curriculum. You can begin to have a consultation companies that can consult agencies, consult local school districts. You know, you guys are going to be the next billionaires in the United States.
Well, the other thing you could do, too, is write a homeschool criteria on the Constitution.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can take your constitutional moments, and as you study it, you know, you can be building your course on the Constitution based on the reports you make each week. Mm-hmm. We're going to keep you busy. We recognize talent here. Whenever I recognize talent, see, this show is all about opportunities, of giving people opportunities that they would never think of just by showing a little initiative. You show a little initiative, we're going to give you the opportunity to show a lot of initiative. And so this is, you know, I see tremendous potential in you. So this is why you know, Pianca and I are just throwing all this stuff on you. So you're going to have a lot of fun listening to the podcast going, they want me to do what? I didn't hear that part. You know, so you'll get all that later on. Okay. All right, so that's the first one. I would change that to make it more, not that they will pass the legislation. We want to give them the legislation that will pass. Section 2, the United States citizenship test currently requires a United States Citizenship Immigration and Services officer to administer 10 out of the 100 questions. Is that all I took? I can't believe that. In this bill, we require the candidate to answer all 100 questions before attaining or maintaining an elected position. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that provision.
Just 10 questions is too easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, here's what I would add to it, though. Now, here's something a little different. Because of the nature of cheating, because of the nature of studying, because of the nature of they can kind of, you know, give the pat answer in a written test, I would give them an oral exam that is publicly recorded live. I would ask them the questions live in a random order and see what they say. Now, they'll study up on it. And even if they do study up on it, that's good. So part of this, we're not trying to catch people and prevent them from running for office. We want them to learn this material. So the fact that you ask 100 questions and they're tested on it orally and it's recorded live and broadcast live, so it can't be edited, I would add that provision in.
Absolutely.
What do you think? Pianca likes it. Amber, what do you think?
That's where we go through our aviation exams, don't we?
We have oral exams, yeah. If you ever take a flight test. Amber, you should learn to fly, too. We'll talk about that as well. Have you ever thought of it?
My sister actually wants to be a pilot.
Okay, good. Well, I got a book.
I have flown a plane a couple of times.
Okay, perfect. See, how did I know that? So I wrote a book called The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. It's all the things that the FAA and your instructor won't teach you. I used to be a flight instructor, and Pianca's a pilot, too.
Okay.
So when your empire builds, you got to get yourself a corporate plane. I'm going to get a Viper Jet Mark II myself. It's got 12,000 foot per minute rate of climb. It's fully aerobatic, and Pianca and I are going to go rage over the skies. I'm going to go grab them one day from the middle of the country, and we're just going to go have fun. So yeah, so toys are an essential. Toys are part of freedom. I'm sorry, yeah, but if you look into it, there's my shameless plug. Look up me, Greg Penglis, on Amazon, and you'll see the complete guide. Well, actually, now that we have, let me take a moment to play my shameless plug, because there's a lot of things I haven't played today's show. We've been busy. But take 55 seconds. We'll be right back. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com. There we go. There's my shameless plug. So we'll get you flying, too. Do you have friends that are interested in politics? Do you have maybe like a club or something or an organization that maybe can help you with some of these things? Or, you know, I don't know. Are you the only one interested?
I'm not a part of a specific club, but I am in contact with multiple representatives and legislators in my area that I can present them with.
Yeah, I think I might have to make the Action Radio Constitutional Group and make you a moderator. and you can just put stuff on there from your constant. See all the fun we're going to have? And you thought you were just going to talk to me about your bill. Hey, Pianki, what do you think? You think we should have Amber help run our Action Radio constitutional page? Do you think we need a constitutional page? I do. I just thought of it. I'm going to write that down for myself for ideas. Pianki?
Well, yes. You know, I'm always have constantly been on everyone that I get sick and tired of looking at these movements, and the people that's consisting of the movements are all over 50. You're making policies, recommendations, and changes that young people mm-hmm. have to live with. So therefore, they should be there in order to help architect and structure what it is that you're contemplating.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think also that I think your generation is much more, I mean, you basically have, you know, computers in your DNA. So Pianki and I didn't grow up with them. We had phones that had, you know, dials that actually turned, you know, you had to put your finger in and, you know, make the dial move. That's where we started life. So answering machines were like a novel concept to us, but you're already there. You know, you're probably born with a computer in your hand. So this is not a big deal for you to be able to sit down at a website, write out a bill, and which may end up on the president's desk one day. I mean, this is the potential. This is why I got Action Radio going. But it really requires younger folks, because the older folks are used to complaining, right. And they're really good at it. And they've raised complaining to an art form. But that doesn't get anything accomplished. You look at the Republicans right now. I call them the gelding old party. And if you don't know gelding, you can look it up. But they don't do anything. You know, they want votes and they want money, but they don't actually want to change anything. And you do. And so this is what separates you apart. And I think younger folks are much more amenable to the new technology, especially when it comes to writing a bill. So for you, it's not as big a jump to do this as opposed to older folks that, they're used to complaining and what can I do? And they're already beaten down by the system too much. So another encouraging thing in your favor. What do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree. Okay. You know, it's our generation that's going to be in government next. You know, why don't we get involved now?
Sounds good to me. All right, yes. Section 3. Go ahead, Pianki.
We need to have more young people holding these politicians and others accountable. What they're doing now is when they see you come in, they say, oh, look at them. Aren't they cute? Let's look at them. You want to change that. You want to change that to where they say, oh, my God, here they come again. Oh.
Oh, no. The kids are after us. Yeah.
Make them afraid of you.
Yeah, I love it. And here's the thing, too. Our youngest person ever, Christian Frenette, he's the son of Shelby, our cruise and travel person. He started here at 11. He's 14 years old now, and we talk history with him. So age is no barrier on the show. It's what you can do. And so, you know, you're being treated exactly as I would treat anybody, as an adult, you know, with a brain, with capability, and we just want to make you better and give you some ideas that'll help, you know, make a stronger bill. But you've already brought to the table, you know, so much that this is I got someone. Josie wants to talk to you. Let's bring her on right now. So Josie's one of our reporters. She does the Latino report. Josie, you're a little breezy on the wind there. Are you driving?
I'm sorry, yes, but I wanted to say a couple words. I'm
feel
proud
free.
Of you being 17 with the knowledge that you have to love your country. It's awesome. As a Latina that I am, legal Latina, I took the test, and of course they only ask about 6 questions out of 100. But you have to study them all because you don't know which ones they're going to ask. And I truly believe that a lot of these politicians, they do not have a clue about their own government constitutional rights and amendments, because look at how they're abusing our system. They hate America completely. And, you know, young people like Pianki was just saying, he's absolutely correct. We need more young people like you to get involved and to stand for your country. And that's what happened in Chile, South America just now. A lot of young people got involved running the country. Of course, in this sad story is that these young people are radical left communists. And they just took over the country and they stole the election. But I don't want that to happen here. I want for people like you to love and stand for the United States of America.
Yeah.
Amber, what do you think?
I will do my best. I'm trying.
No, you're doing fine. Yeah, and don't be afraid to make mistakes and just totally screw things up, and that's all part of the process. You know, I mean, you know, we make mistakes here all the time. We're pioneers, and whenever you're a pioneer, there is no guidepost. There is no citizen legislative guideline. Nobody knows, you know, how this is going to work. Least of all me, and I'm the one that started this whole mess. You know, so just jump right in with us. And in fact, actually, if you get on Facebook, we have an Action Radio legal page, and you could. You know, maybe that's something you could post there too. That's a possibility to think about too. All right, we've got we've done most of the sections here. Section 3, I think we said, the United States citizenship test scores and the number of attempts of the candidates, I like that part, will be recorded on a public website. Once the scores become available, the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services will post the grade received on a public website. So you actually want these folks to take, not only take the citizenship through the immigration citizenship and immigration department, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I didn't really have like a third party option that would do that that wasn't biased. And so the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services was the closest thing I had to a non-biased option that wasn't going to hopefully mess up the scores.
Well, here's my question, though. Yeah, and I want to let you think about this for a little bit. As the Justice Department, you know, with the lady with the blindfold and the scales and all that kind of stuff, you know, as the Justice Department is supposed to be impartial, we know that the FBI has become the FBI KGB. We know that Merrick Garland,
right,
you know, is persecuting and prosecuting parents, which he calls terrorists, for simply questioning their Marxist school boards. So who's to say that the immigration would not be slanted by either the Democrats or Republicans to let in incumbents or give different questions or provide the answers ahead of time and slant it? This is why I want it to be an oral exam given, you know, and I'm not sure how to do it. This is something to work on, is to how are these questions going to be asked, you know. You just draw questions out of a barrel, you know. I mean, to get the impartiality.
Right.
But I think if we test these people openly in public on a live video by a certified testing agency, you can still use the questions. Then maybe immigration would be required to supply the questions that they're using, or we can make up our own questions. These are all things to think about.
Right.
But
yeah.
My Pianchi, go ahead. You know where I'm going with this, right?
Make up your own questions. And just like the ACT, SAT test, no test, two tests are exactly alike in sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have several tests. You know what I'm talking about. Have several tests that's going to basically cover the same objective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Amber?
I wrote this during COVID. And so, like, we didn't have all the exams were done online, and we didn't have the people to have everybody be in a room to administer it. And so my thought process was, well, might as well, since everything's online, might as well just do it online, but take every necessary precaution against cheating that we possibly could do. So that was because of COVID and all that, it was kind of like, what do we do?
Well, what do you think would offer a better system? Should we do written and oral? Should we just do the oral on video? So this is the idea I had when I was reading your bill on the last couple of days, is that if we could have an oral exam on live video, so it can't be edited, it goes out live.
Right.
Anybody like C-SPAN should do it, or so we'll find some service that would carry it and not edit it. That to me seems the least way that can be cheated. If they're getting the questions right, it's like a debate format, you know, we know Hillary got the questions ahead of time. But in other words, if we can make it as impartial, and nothing's perfect, you know, we do our best, but just the fact that they have to answer it, but on their feet, you know, in front of a live, hopefully a live audience, and just give them the questions and you know, 2 minutes for an answer per question.
Right.
Just do only so many candidates so people don't lose interest, but yeah. You know, and I think that might work. And you can do a written one, too. Think about it. Think about which way you think might be the
written ones especially. Yeah, we want to make sure they can read and write.
That's a good point, too.
Yeah.
Now, should we publish? Should we have their things published? We should publish their answers online, too, then, shouldn't we, Amber?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay.
Especially the written answers.
Having not only the scores.
Yeah, but publish their written answers. Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe that shows their ability to put their thought into print. And you would be surprised if people can't put their thought into legible print where you can understand what the hell not only they're talking about, what they're thinking about.
Right.
Yeah, this is a great bill. I really like this bill. Jesse, do you have any suggestions for Amber?
No. Hold on a second. I had her on speaker. No, that sounds good, actually. And it's funny that she mentioned she wrote this during COVID, and that was going to be my question. What made you think of writing this particular topic? How did you come about? And you kind of mentioned it a little bit about it. So,
during the lockdown.
Yeah. And do your parents are patriots or they love America and they teach you as a little girl to love America?
Good. Yeah, my whole family, we weren't super involved in politics, and then COVID hit, and we were like, okay, that's it. The draw's the line. And
COVID divided us into the compliant and the resistant. And you know where we all are. So it's just fascinating. What do you think of COVID? As a young person with your government, you know, talking freedom and democracy, even though we're a republic, and talking about all the things that, you know, the ideals, and then locking people down and having you all wear masks and taking away your schooling. Mm-hmm. And well, you're homeschooled anyway, so it doesn't matter. But taking away the family businesses, taking away the big stores were open, the small stores weren't, you know, and everybody working from home. How did that strike you?
It's honestly truly irritating. Like the government telling us what stores we can go to, what we can't go to, how we have to dress, how we have to wear our clothing, when we have to wear a mask, who can and can't enter buildings, stuff like that. It's ridiculous. And that should be left up to the state specifically, but more specifically the businesses themselves. Under no circumstances should that be regulated by any form of government.
Well, it's such a violation of our Constitution to do that. It's just, you know, I mean, due process went out the window. Search and seizure went out the window. We had Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, you know, Sixth, all of this, like a bunch of things that were violated, none of which was legal. We still have to address that. I'm going to have to let you go in a couple of minutes because I got to play something, and I think we're pretty much done. The only thing I would do also, Section 6, this act will take effect on September 1st, 2023. There's no way to guarantee that, either before or after. I would just take that out. Don't give them a date. And change that first section. And now I think we've covered. Yeah, go ahead, Jesse.
Can I just say I'm proud of you as a young girl, and keep up the good work. And I'm sure you can share this show today with some of your young friends, and they can write a bill too. You know, it's very easy. Greg helped me write one, and we worked together. Fingerprint ID, so we can stop the fraud on voting and dead people voting in this country. So I'm proud of you.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Well, take care. Go through them,
yeah. And those American soldiers that fought in American wars, people that's running for elected office, Congress, they must know that they all did, and they must be able to name the wars that they fought in, name what they contributed, their position, so on. Because Robert E. Lee fought in the Mexican-American War, he fought in the Civil War, some of them fought in the Spanish. They are associated with one thing, and they are denigrated to the point where people want to destroy. So, no, we have to make sure that they know these.
I wonder if the 1776 project would help you. You've got the 1619 project that says we're all a bunch of racists, which is a bunch of nonsense.
Right.
But the 1776 was Trump's project to put civics, you know, back in the classroom. Look them up. See if the, you know, tell them what you're doing, and show them the bill, and see if they can give you some help. That might work out as well.
Yeah.
But the one thing I want to leave you with is to think about, you know, doing a constitutional, you know, report each week. And whether it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, just pick a section, a small, just if it's just one line of the Constitution, you know, this is what I think, this is where it came from, this is, you know, something like that. And we'll worry about getting you moderating our groups and everything else some other time. But I would work on the bill, and I would definitely want to have you on, you know, once a week for a short time. I'll find a place. We'll find a place that works. especially as you go through college, because then we're going to have you do a college report. That's going to be fun, too. Have you picked a college?
I mean, so much can come out of this.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
So much can come out of even on this issue about slavery. Talk about how did these Africans get here? How did they get expelled from their country? For what? Because the story always started on these shores. But no, a lot had to do before they got here. And the issue about whites going into Africa, kidnapping people, is just not true.
We need history questions. As Bianchi says, we can put some history questions on the test, too. It doesn't have to be just straight citizenship constitutional issues. So all those things would apply as well. Bianchi, I post something, the five greatest myths of slavery on the Action Radio group. And so there's another place, another resource for you, Amber, as well as the our Facebook page, the Action Radio Group. We've got the Action Radio Legal Project. We've got a bunch of stuff. We've got our Citizen Legislative page. You've got writeyourlaws.com. I just want to thank you. I want to thank you, you know, so much for doing this. Think about everything we've said. Listen to the podcast. Get back in touch with me, you know, when you're ready to start doing a regular report. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate my time here and everything that y'all are doing with Write Your Laws.
All right. Now, I just found out from a friend of mine that we actually have a little bit more time than the 3 hours I thought I had. So I'm going to play our Santa Rosa Volunteers piece. I can't take any more new callers. They're going to shut that down. I'll probably shut you guys down. But let me just play a couple things on our way out of here because we had so much fun. So Bianchi, Josie, Amber, thank you so much. Shirley, Tess was on earlier. Derek, who called in earlier, who's probably the Blue Angels by now. This has been a really great show.
I'm heading that way.
You're going to the Blue Angels
too? God bless.
We'll get a report next time you call in, okay? All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care, everybody. I'm going to play a couple things, and then I'll be off too. And I'll see you all Monday at 7:00 in the morning Central
Time. This is a great segment right here, Greg. Have to hand it to you.
Oh well, hey, thank Amber. I just sat here behind a microphone. I had the easy job. Okay, I'll be back later. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents. Sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. This is one of the shortest of any Federalist or Anti-Federalist papers and gets right to the main issue of taxes in the first paragraph. It's written by Cincinnatus, whom we've heard from before. And this paper is in response to Hamilton's Federalist No. 12 plan for the United States to make lots of money under the Constitution. He begins Anti-Federalist No. 12. On the subject of taxation, in which powers are to be given so largely by the new Constitution, you lull our fears of abuse by venturing to predict that the great revenue of the United States must and always will be raised by impost, and you elevate our hopes by holding out the reviving and supporting the national credit. If you have any other plan for this than by raising money upon the people to pay the interest of the national debt, your ingenuity will deserve our thanks. Supposing, however, that raising money is necessary to payment of the interest, and such a payment is requisite to support the credit of the Union, let us see how much will be necessary for that end, and how far the impost will supply what we want. He then proceeds in a bunch of numbers to back up his claim that the scheme basically won't work, will cost more than expected, and taxes will have to be raised. All the same problems we have today in the trillions of dollars of national debt. The money to run the country is supposed to come from imposts, which are taxes on imported goods. What Cincinnatus is questioning is whether the figures of revenue raised are accurate or intentionally misleading. This leads to the accusation still around today that government officials are either stupid or liars. He says, "We know too that our imports diminish yearly and from the nature of things must continue to diminish, and consequently that the above estimate of the produce of the impost will in all probability
fall much short of the supposed sum. But even without this, it must appear that you were either intentionally misleading your hearers or were very little acquainted with the subject when you ventured to predict that the great revenue of the United States would always flow from the impost. This also documents the long-standing practice that government revenues will be short of estimates and costs will be higher. Cincinnatus then correctly states that when the federal government can't cover its bills the way it says it can, they will go to the state to cover the debt. And that is a great reason not to ratify the Constitution. The power to tax is uncontrolled with regard to the states. He says, it will be expected that the new government will provide for this also, and such expectation is founded not only on the promise you hold forth of its reviving and supporting public credit among us, but also on this unavoidable principle of justice, that is, the new government takes away the impost and other substantial taxes from the produce of which the several states paid the interest of their debt or funded the paper with which they paid it. The new government must find ways and means of supplying that deficiency in hard money, for paper cannot be used without a violation of the principles it boasts. Cincinnatus is really good at explaining things and doesn't need any help from me. In his final paragraph, he clearly delineates the differences between the current Articles of Confederation and the proposed Constitution, and talks of the realities of the former compared to the expectations of the latter. Well, expectations are easy to declare, but much harder to meet, which is the point of the final paragraph, that the Federalists simply want the people to trust them, and they will manage everything. Sound familiar? However, Cincinnatus warns that the more likely end for such an all-encompassing grant of power is that the wealth will be squandered, the revenues will not be raised, and the full faith and credit of the United States will be ruined. And now, the national debt stands at some $30 trillion. Cincinnatus concludes, the present government promises nothing, the intended government everything. From the present government, little is expected, from the intended one, much. Because it is conceived that to the latter much is given, to the former little. And yet the inability of the people to pay what is required in specie, remaining the same, the funds of the one will not much exceed those of the other. The public creditors are easy with the present government from a conviction of its inability to pay. They will be urgent with the new one from an opinion that as is promised, so it can and will perform everything. Whether the change will be for our prosperity and honor is yet to be tried. Perhaps it will be found that the supposed want of power in Congress to levy taxes is, at present, a veil happily thrown over the inability of the people, and that the large powers given to the new government will, to every one, expose the nakedness of our land. Certain it is that if the expectations which are grafted on the gift of those plenary powers are not answered, our credit will be irretrievably ruined. Action Radio is now sponsoring a constitutional amendment to remove the power of Congress to borrow money. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it.
This is Greg Penglis for Strike Force, your source for pure energy. Strike Force is a concentrated energy drink that turns a half liter of your favorite beverage into an energy drink. It contains caffeine, taurine, B vitamins, and potassium. You make your energy drink yourself. Strike Force energy drinks come in original, grape, lemon, and orange. Action Radio is an affiliate of Strike Force, so our listeners get a 20% discount. All you do is add our code, WYL, to the discount code window at checkout. WYL comes from our website, Write Your Laws. So, you can get your energy drink, a 20% discount, and help Action Radio change the relationship of we the people to our government. Not bad. Strike Force is at StrikeForceEnergy.com. That's StrikeForceEnergy.com. Start your engines. You are listening to Action Radio Online with Greg Penglis. The webpage for all Action Radio shows and podcasts is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Please share our show with all your friends and family, both nationally and internationally. The guiding principle of Action Radio is this: we the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed.
And that's it for this week. I'll be back Monday morning at 7 o'clock Central Time. See you then.